Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient
tea. All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It's Tuesday. That means two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, two for two. Whoa, that sounds different. What the hell's going on? Hold on.
Wait a minute.
Let's try that. Don't be messing around with my reverb, man. That was weird. That was just weird, man. Yeah, that's better. That's better. Two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Tom's laughing his ass off in there. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. You all right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That also took me by surprise.
It's like, what was that?
That was a cool new effect.
Yeah.
I was like, what did you guys do when I was
don't
gone?
Be messing around. Don't be messing around with this stuff, man. This is very high-tech equipment here. Hey, welcome everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Two for Tuesday, get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Coming up on the show after 1:30, we're going to have some members from the band The Phantom Broadcast here. They got a Kickstarter campaign going to raise some money for their latest music that they're going to release on vinyl. And you can do that. They also have a gig coming up at Shuba's and a new album. So we're going to have four members from the Phantom Broadcast here live in studio. We'll talk to them and we'll hear a little bit of their music as well. So that's coming up. Also, I have an article about the original endings of movies, because as we all know, that sometimes an ending of a movie is changed for whatever reason, significant reason. You know, producers didn't like it. It didn't work. And sometimes those endings, the original endings, are kind of weird. And we've got some actual original endings from movies that some of them you won't believe how some of these movies were supposed to end. So endings of original movie or original movie endings that were changed. We also have the best animal attack movies in honor of Crawl. So we're going to talk about some of the animal attack movies. And also today, obviously, the Amazon opened for business. Yesterday in history, and of course we had the Amazon Prime insanity going on, but then that's going to get us to talk about some of the most recognizable company logos ever, because obviously the Amazon logo is very recognizable and everybody knows what it is. So we'll talk about some of the other fantastic company logos right here. So that's what's coming up on the show. We all want you to stay tuned. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. The text was not working during the show yesterday, but it's up and running now, right, Tom?
Yes, sir, yes, sir.
So you can get your texts in right now at 312-981-7200, your 2 for Tuesday request.
Yeah.
312-981-7200. There you go. And that's what's coming up. Well, let's say hello to the guys I work with every morning. Tom Hush is back. How was your little weekend?
It was great. It was a lot of fun. Kind of got bit up, though, by the skeeters.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it was a great time.
Yeah. A little hot out there, though.
Yeah, you could say that. It was one of those days where I was glad to have sunscreen and shorts.
Yeah.
It was very nice, though. It was nice to get that in.
Dangerously hot this coming weekend.
Yes.
Like, ridiculous. Just be careful. And all that stuff. God, I hate this weather so much. I just hate hot weather. Ugh, can't stand it. It looks like we're going to be comfortable, though, for tomorrow night's screening of outside screening of Caddyshack.
It'll be perfect.
I don't think it's not going to be ultra hot tomorrow. It's going to be warm, a little muggy, but in the evening, I don't think it's going to be bad, and it doesn't look like we're going to get rain. So I hope everybody can make it out to see Caddyshack outside, right outside in the courtyard of the beautiful Crown Plaza Hotel, which is located, the courtyard is located 12 feet away from the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant. And we want you to come out. Get down there early. Go to Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant. Parking is right there in the parking lot. Just pull right in, park, get in there. You get 15% off on all your food. So you can go to Murray Brothers Caddyshack, have some dinner, 15% off the food, and then they'll add $10 for your admission to see Caddyshack. And then you just walk right outside, take a seat. I'll introduce the movie. It'll start at dusk, which will be around 9 o'clock. And we'll all laugh while we watch one of the greatest comedies of all time, Caddyshack, on the big screen outside. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Again, Caddyshack, I'll give you the phone number for Murray Brothers Caddyshack a little bit later on. Make your reservations, though. You can call Murray Brothers Caddyshack. And we want to pack the place and have some fun and sit outside. It looks like it's going to be a pleasant evening weather-wise before the heat comes rolling in, before the extreme heat comes rolling in. So, but anyway, come on out tomorrow night and see Caddyshack outside. Again, right outside the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant in Rosemont, which is located at the Crown Plaza Hotel right there in Rosemont. So there you go. Looks like we'll have okay weather for that. Well, welcome back, Tom.
Glad to be here.
All right. And in the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Vic, how are you?
Well, I'm doing well, sir.
All right. You know, we were talking off the air. I didn't realize this, but you were in New York on Saturday.
Yeah.
And we were talking off the air. You missed the blackout by, what, 6 minutes, you said?
I would say less than 10 minutes, Nick, because, and I can't remember the exact time, so I don't want to quote times, but I do remember when I got on the plane and, you know, those little TVs in front of you, on the chair in front of you, that's when I learned about it. It was just happening. And Jeannie and I, she was across the aisle. We couldn't get seats together.
Yeah.
I looked over and she was watching a movie and I said, there's a power outage in Manhattan. It's like 40,000 people have no lights. And then it jumped up to more than 70,000. So we would have been stuck there for sure.
Yeah, no question about it. Because, like, you know, just hours earlier, a few hours earlier, you were in Times Square. And I know that you posted a video on Facebook.
We were there just minutes before it happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah, we jumped in a cab because we had an 8 o'clock flight out of Newark back to Chicago, and we had enough time to get there, so we jumped in a cab, and it just happened. It happened literally. I think it was 7 or 8 minutes after we left. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, I was shocked.
I
didn't know this, but I don't know if you're aware of this, but I do. I don't even have any reverb button in here. Not even like the one you don't like. So if you want to have the engineers put that in here, we'll be set up.
Oh, I can set you up for reverb.
Yeah, I'd like that.
Well, wait a minute. Reverb. Hold on a second. Hold on a minute.
Okay.
Hold on. Okay.
We got it?
Got it. Go.
Check.
Yeah! There you go, man.
Okay, that's pretty
good. News and reverb.
Yeah, you do the news and reverb.
Oh, man, I would love it. Just parts.
I'm sure management would enjoy that. Sure that they would really enjoy that.
And Sunday.
Yeah.
We could just do the closeout, maybe.
We could do the whole show in reverb.
We better not.
Yeah. So, all right. Well. Welcome back, Vic. How you doing, man?
Thank you, sir.
Good to see you. And Vic will be covering your news all morning long right here on 720 WGN. So the blackout in New York, by the way, that took place in Manhattan, some of the footage that they've been, you know, showing that's popping up on the internet and on TV and on talk shows and stuff, Jennifer Lopez had a big concert in Madison Square Garden. Right in the middle of it, everything went out, like everything. That's got to be terrifying, being in the middle of Madison Square Garden and like nothing. And they actually showed footage of people, like obviously you've seen. I'm assuming people saw all the Broadway musical casts that were coming out onto the streets and performing.
They were just coming out and doing like, all right, let's do a number.
Oh yeah. All the Broadway theaters up and down the strips there in Midtown. The cast members were coming out onto the street and singing and performing.
And there was one group that was dozens of kids, right? Like high school kids. That was pretty cool.
It was just like all, if you walk through the Broadway section, well, you know, right when the power outage happened, groups of actors and singers and Broadway performers were out on the street. And there were like
how much money I could have saved.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. Trevor Noah was talking about it last night on The Daily Show, and he's like, he goes, if you want advice when you come to New York and you can't get those, you know, you can't get those tickets to Hamilton, just cut off the power, man, and stand right outside. They'll come right out to you.
Get a private performance from Lin-Manuel Miranda.
But those, and those tickets are not cheap, man.
No, sir.
No. Broadway shows cost you a lot of money. And so if you're just walking down the street and suddenly, you know, there's a bunch of Broadway actors out on the street performing, that's pretty funny. That's pretty cool. You know, you got to love Broadway.
After, you know, hindsight, I wouldn't have minded getting stuck in all that. It kind of looked like fun.
Yeah.
New Yorkers figured out a way to make it fun.
I'll tell you, you know, I will say this, though. You know, when you were reporting on it yesterday morning, Vic, and you said that there were, like, over 400 people trapped in elevators. Like,
yeah.
That's
what I was wondering, and I told Jeannie on the flight, I hope the people in elevators
I can't even imagine.
A snack with them. And
I can't even imagine.
400.
We had
an issue this year or last year where we had an issue with it, where an elevator, people were stuck on an elevator, and it was a pretty big story. Can you imagine 400 people in Chicago being stuck in elevators?
I mean, that's just terrifying. It's terrifying. So, all right. Well, anyway, the power's back in New York, and now you still have to pay $250 to see a show. No more freebies on the street. So, all right, we are going to take a break here. And again, coming up after 1:30, we'll have members from the band The Phantom Broadcast. They'll be here to talk about Iniquities, their vinyl release. And they got an upcoming gig at Shuba's. And we will hear a song from the latest record and talk music with those guys. That's coming up. But when we come back, I have got this fantastic, gigantic article that I'm just going to keep around and dig in every once in a while. I have all the great ways that aluminum foil can change your life. We've all got a roll of aluminum foil in our kitchen at home. Everybody does. And so here are some unbelievable ways that aluminum foil can change your life. I like to give tips, you know?
It's for, you know, for the everyday man.
That's exactly.
For the layman.
That's right. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio. Coming up after the 1:30 news, members of the band The Phantom Broadcast are going to join us to talk about their new vinyl release and their upcoming gig at Shuba's. And we'll hear a full song from the band as we get to know them and talk about their music. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. A couple of texts came through. By the way, the texts were down last night, but they're up and running now, so get your texts in now. Two for Tuesday request, too. Yeah! And that's 312-981-7200. 630 area code says, I would totally listen to a whole show in reverb. God. And then 804 area code, here's a reverb text. Yeah! Okay, thank you. Yeah, you know, a lot of the broadcasters on the AM sides of like Top 40 radio would use reverb pretty regularly. Would have a bit of reverb. The most legendary of which would be Larry Lujack. Larry Lujack would have the reverb set about here. Yeah. Animal Stories. He would have the reverb set pretty much right there all the time. And that guy's a legendary guy. Was a legend. So. All right. Aluminum foil. You all have it? You all have it in your house?
I've got aluminium.
Oh, please. here's our ways that you can use aluminum foil. It replaces a funnel. So we've all needed to pour liquid back into a jar after pouring too much out. Maybe, or some wine back into a bottle, or perhaps gas into a tank. Either way, if you don't have a funnel around, it can be tricky. But with aluminum foil, you can, as you tear some off, form a handmade funnel, wrap it around any sized hole, and gently place the liquid back into the original container, and you never have to buy a funnel again. You see that?
I'm going to toss my funnel today.
Just throw it out.
Who needs it? Not when I've got aluminum foil.
Aluminum foil also. How do you say controversy?
Controversy. advertisement.
Yeah. Unwrinkles clothes. If you place some aluminum foil under clothes while you iron them, it can help smoothen the surface and decrease your creases. I bet you never thought that foil and heat would be such a good match. Next time you iron, wrap some of the heat conductor under your shirt and place it on a boiling hot iron and onto the surface. You won't believe how much it works. So look at that. Place it under the shirt. Like basically line your ironing board with aluminum foil.
I would be way too afraid that it would burn or something.
Like what would burn?
Like the aluminum.
No, well, you put aluminum foil in grills. You put it in ovens. True. I mean, that's what it's made for.
Used it to wrap sandwiches.
It's made to be cooked in. It's made to go into ovens and go on stovetops and to go on to barbecues and grills. That's why it exists. It also, you can sharpen scissors with aluminum foil. Bet you never thought about how many uses there are for aluminum foil, but it says, think of aluminum foil as the perfect item to sharpen and clean your scissors. We all know that they can become stiff and rusted over time. It's something to be expected when we use them for long periods of time. Next time you see your scissors seemingly reaching the end of their life, quickly grab some aluminum foil and gently cut into it 7 to 10 times. After a short while, they will get cleaner and sharper and ready for the next use.
Well, that I will try. That I'm definitely going to try.
Wow. It also removes static from your clothes. If there's anything we hate, it's static from your fresh load of laundry. It can be a split shocking second that can cause a minor inconvenience. So why do we put up with it? Here's a better idea. With aluminum foil, you can place a small ball of aluminum foil in your dryer along with your clothes and remove any static that might occur during the cycle. Once you try this, you'll never be able to stop. Really, a ball of aluminum foil into the dryer.
It'll save me on bounce.
Yeah. Yeah, but you won't get that lovely smell. That's the thing. So, all right. It's aluminum foil, man. And I've got plenty more here that we're going to just save from time to time. Every once in a while, I'll just give you an aluminum foil tip. It'll be happening for this is a huge article, so it'll be happening for the next couple of months, I think. So, all right, let's take a break. When we come back, we got the news, and then after the news, members of the Phantom Broadcast, that band, will be here live in studio. And they're in the PPG Paints Green Room, by the way, the fantastic PPG Paints Green Room. And we'll get them in here in a couple of minutes. Let's get to the news after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. And it's Tuesday morning, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now at 312-981-7200. We'll do that a little bit later on. The music that you just heard is from a band called The Phantom Broadcast. You can check out thephantombroadcast.bandcamp.com. And we have live in studio here three members of the band. We have Nick Soria. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
And I'm Nick as well. How about that? It'll be easier to remember.
Everywhere I go, there's always Nick's.
Yeah. Dave Hollis. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Nick.
And then Evan Opitz.
Good job on
okay.
that one.
Okay, Evan Opitz.
Some people get that wrong.
Very cool. Phantom Broadcast. Well, welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah. So you're excited about the vinyl pressing of Antiquities Volume 1, correct?
Yeah, we're doing... like really well. So we have a Kickstarter going right now.
Right.
30-day campaign. We nailed out the details like right before we sent it out, and we're super happy with the turnout. Like, it's been really you can like look at the analytics on the Kickstarter thing when you like log in. And we were just looking at it before we came over here actually, and it's just been consistent. There hasn't really been like a bump or like a fall off in activity. So it seems like we have like we're two-thirds of the way there, and we still have half of our campaign to go.
And you're looking to do 250 vinyl records with Gatefold and all kinds of and merch and to raise some money for merch and stuff like that.
Yeah. It comes with T-shirts, prints, Gatefold vinyl, and digital download of the full record.
That's great.
So far, we're about a grand away from our goal,
and
we have 17 days to go.
Well, maybe we can get some people out there to get to go to your Kickstarter. Is it hooked up on your Facebook or on your website and everything?
Yeah, so it's we have links on our Instagram in the bio, classic Lincoln bio, and we're at the Phantom Broadcast _.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the full at the Phantom Broadcast, and then one _ at the end.
And then your website is thephantombroadcast.com.
Correct.
So kick these guys some money. Give these guys some money. Yeah. So let's start with how long you guys been together?
Well, the band has been around for quite a while now, but this iteration of the band is, I want to say, about two years
current iteration has been in its form.
Different involvements from different members. Nick's definitely been like the longest member outside of Evan. Evan is essentially the founder of Phantom Broadcast LLC.
there are two other members that couldn't make it this morning. Want to give a shout out to them so that they get mentioned?
Yeah, mad shout out to Colin. He has to get up at 5 a.m. tomorrow when the show ends.
That's when my show ends. Yeah.
We gave him a break.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were like, you don't need to be here. Yeah. You know, it'd be a crazy day for him.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
He plays drums for us. Mm-hmm. He also plays auxiliary percussion and a couple orchestral instruments as well, like glockenspiel.
Shows all up over the record.
Quite a bit, yeah.
Okay.
And then Lucy Little, who is currently, where is Lucy? Is
somewhere
Lucy
in Europe.
She's based in Amsterdam right now on, I want to say, a Fulbright scholarship, but like she's been all over Europe the entire time she's been there.
What does she do in the band?
She plays violin. She also does some vocals.
Okay, very cool.
And actually, on one of the tracks, she took a deliberate role on kind of doing, I don't know, like a type of sound manipulation.
A voice collage, if you will. Yeah. She took some like recorded audio of what sounds simple, but it was just what the song meant to us, because it was,
what was the last track on the record? It was the last track on our upcoming volume 2 is Topaz. And we kind of talked a little bit. Dave and I kind of wrote separately lyrical ideas that somehow kind of gravitated together a little bit. And we kind of talked about what it meant.
Well, tell me about the band. What's the vision? What kind of stuff do you guys, how would you categorize your band?
I would categorize it as ever evolving and,
did you mean a genre?
Like influences and things like that. What influences you guys?
People tell us they hear prog. Mm-hmm. I'm one of my mom's friends with no point of reference except like just hearing us. She lives in a different state. Said yes. She was like, sounds like yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel we do definitely have a lot of prog influence, like deep at our core. Like Evan and I share a love of King Crimson. I don't know if Nick, you have any like.
Evan and I share a lot of like Minus the Bear influence, I would say.
Yeah, like modern. Yes.
And I kind of use that same answer too, like just to, you know, spare the conversation of having to like really explain things. Just be like, well, it's prog rock, but it, you know, if you listen to it, it's, I don't know, I guess it's a little bit different.
It's an umbrella term for sure.
Genres are like a hole that you can fall into, boxing things up and being like, it sounds like this, when it's like.
Well, you're in a room with a big prog rock fan, so that's.
All right. So, yeah. Excellent.
I've seen Yes. I saw Yes. I've seen him like 12 times. And
such a great band.
Amazing. And I saw him in their heyday, too. I was lucky enough to see him like in 1977. And their musicianship in that band is ridiculous.
That's something that we get told is like people are like, oh, it's obvious that you are all trained musicians.
Is that the case?
Yeah,
for the most part, we're all in some capacity involved with a school of music to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
We're not all necessarily music majors, or we don't necessarily all have degrees in music.
I think that might be me. Dave, you have a degree in music, right?
Yeah, I do.
Okay,
yeah.
So I'm the only one in this band who does not have a degree in music.
All right, well, let's go down the line here. Let's start with Nick. Nick, what's your background? Where are you from?
Background where I'm from? I'm from a far north suburb of Chicago called Antioch. I met Evan about 2011, we were both attending the summer jazz camp at Northern Illinois University, and he saw me wearing a Coheed and Cambria shirt and came up and said hi, and so we kind of became friends off that.
That's so cute.
You know, we did the whole, like, Facebook friend things at the end of camp, and, you know...
And what's your background musically? When did you start playing?
I started playing bass when I was 12 years old. It was just like, you know, friends hanging out and having a sleepover. And be like, what if we started a band? I'm like, well, my brother plays bass, so he can teach me that. So I was like mostly a self-taught student of bass. I did like jazz band and all that stuff in high school. And then when I got to college at University of Illinois, where Evan and I met up again.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did we meet up again, but we just so happened to be living in the same dorm. And it wasn't until we actually ran into each other face-to-face where we realized that we were going to school
together. That bigger coincidence, right?
Yeah. I don't know. Somehow I missed it on social media that we were also
right
at the same dorm at the same university. So mm-hmm. it was a really cool
mm-hmm.
coincidence.
So my experience is a little all over the place. I'm speaking in broad strokes here, but I have some experience in like most genres of music through high school and playing with like a bunch of different people like throughout college.
Yeah.
So I'm a little all over the place.
All right. What about you?
I grew up in Crystal Lake, Illinois, like your very own Tom Hosch.
Good old Tom. Yeah, that's where his hometown.
Yeah, Tom and I actually, there's a picture of me holding Kyle, I believe.
I think it was actually, it was Kyle, my youngest brother. There's a picture of him holding him that we didn't know existed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty ago. It was pretty okay. funny. Yeah, like a couple years ago, Tom was just like, hey, I have this picture of you like holding my baby brother.
Yeah.
Like while we were like on a soccer team, before we actually like really were friends. Mm-hmm. We like met up in middle school. But Crystal Lake, actually in Crystal Lake, there is a music store called Player's Bench. Shouts out Player's Bench. It's changed hands a couple times since then, but it still retains the same spirit. And that's mm-hmm. upstairs they got lessons, and downstairs they got a really nice music store where kids can just go and touch guitars. And that's pretty much what I did.
And that's how you started?
From when I was about like 12 or 13 on. And I actually at Player's Bench, my first guitar teacher that ever really got me to do anything, his name was Dan Phelps. Tom's guitar teacher too, I believe. I think he was the one that recommended me to
yeah.
Dan Phelps, and he was like, can you read music? And my reply was like, yeah, I can read music. And he was like, can you read music for your instrument? Because I'd been in choir and band and stuff, and I could like read notes and stuff. But he was like, can you like look at a sheet of music and like play it with your guitar? Because I was one of those kids that was just playing tablature, you know, like
yeah.
I found a song that I liked,
yeah.
and I was like, I'm gonna learn how to play this riff. And he was like, you're going to buy a real book right now, a book of jazz standards, and you're going to read out of it. We're going to read out of it every lesson. We're going to do some of that, and you're going to learn how to play notes on your instrument.
And then you went on to major in music.
And I went on to, I went to a conservatory at a liberal arts school at Millikan University, pretty close to Champaign, kind of in like the bulb of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a commercial music degree and a music business dual degree. Commercial music is like, it's partially a performance degree, but really as like a studio musician. It's a lot of like session player stuff. You learn how to like read a quick chart, stuff called Nashville numbers, stuff like that. And then you also do like studio technology. It's like arts tech.
Right.
We have like a studio there. So that's my background. It's like half engineering, half playing.
All right. Evan, what about you?
Well, I mean, it kind of all started with my dad's music collection. I think around fourth or fifth grade, I started picking up things that he would listen to. And sometimes I would wake up late at night and he would be jamming out to records. I woke up one night and he was jamming out to The Cure's record, Blood Flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing that at like 3 in the morning one time, and I was like, what is this, you know? And and I heard like,
There Is No If.
Yeah,
that song's so like
such a great album. Yeah, it's wild. And like, just I was so young too. It was like really impressionable, you know.
Yeah.
Also kind of like this hazy like middle of the night thing I'm hearing in the living room, you know. And so I listened to a lot of that stuff. He had the Smashing Pumpkins, and he had Tubular Bells, Mike Oldfield. I used to listen to that. But he also had like Pink Floyd, and he also had the Tragically Hip, and they got an Audio Slave record, and they got
my dad got me into Chris Cornell when I was like 8 years old. I made him play Black Hole Sun. Like every time we were in the car, we would just like repeat that track because mm-hmm. I just want to hear the song again and again.
Yeah, so I got really into a lot of different styles of music early on in my life, and I knew that I wanted to make music. I knew that I had these songs in me and I wanted to like write songs. Yeah. You know? So, for a long time, I kind of just, I played marching snare in like fifth grade and sixth grade. And, I was in the concert band and I also started taking guitar lessons. And earlier than that, I started taking piano, but the piano I didn't really take seriously.
Yeah.
You know? It wasn't until later on where I started learning how to read music and mm-hmm. actually like be able to sight read and like read charts and stuff like that. But you know, that those were the beginnings for me. I went to this local music store called Rossi Music in Oak Lawn, which is where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about a southwest suburb, about 40-45 minutes away from
home of DZ Fest and DZ Records,
yeah. which was just this last weekend. Which
these two were just playing at.
Yeah.
Shout out to Ben Argelis for putting on that festival every year. It's very, very cool. If you hear about it, you should check it out.
We got to take a break.
Okay.
Hold on a second. And we're talking with members of the Phantom Broadcast. We're going to hear a song, too, from their latest. And they got a gig at Shuba's in August that we'll tell you about as well. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. 2 for Tuesday, get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, we are being visited by Nick, Dave, and Evan from the Phantom Broadcast. That's the band. That's the music you just heard. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks again for having us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. So you guys got a gig coming up in August, Monday, August 12th at Shuba's, a great room.
Yes, sure. Really looking forward to it. It's our first time as this ensemble playing that room, and mm-hmm. it's a free show.
So gotta people should check it out. Yeah, yeah. And you get, and all the information is at thephantombroadcast.com. And again, the Kickstarter campaign is going for another 17 days, you said, right?
That's correct. Right. August 1st.
All right. First, well, tell me about Iniquities, because we're going to hear a song from it. Tell me about it.
So Antiquities is a two-part full sequence. We released the first part on the first volume on April 26th. Is that true? April
mm-hmm.
26th.
Mm-hmm.
That includes
the first four tracks of the album. It's a 9-track album. So
oh,
the
I see.
Second
okay.
half is going to have 5
oh, I see.
Tracks on it.
Okay.
And the vinyl we're pressing is going to be released. Volumes 1 and 2 will be side A and B respectively.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured we could use that first record as a promo of sorts for this campaign that we're doing,
right?
And then to promote the second part of the record for anyone who would need to know
for
digital streaming, etc.
Very, very cool. Okay, we're going to hear a song, but before we do that, every musician that I ever have in here from a band, I always ask them 2 questions. So we'll go down the line. The first one is Nick. What was the first album you ever bought?
First album I ever bought was Warning by Green Day.
Okay.
I was in sixth grade.
Is that you trying to justify buying Green Day because you were in sixth grade?
I will always love them, so
yeah.
I don't need to justify anything.
All right. No, I understand. All right. Dave, what about you?
I think it was, I bought it digitally.
Okay.
Because I had an iPod Shuffle.
Whoa.
You know those little like pregnancy tests?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was Demon Days by Gorillaz.
Oh, okay.
I heard it on a commercial, and I was all like, right. I like that song.
All right. Okay. And then Evan?
I can't think back that far. I want to say it's a tie between AFI's Sing the Sorrow, which came out in 2003, and Bon Jovi's Bounce.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Yeah. Mine was Black Sabbath Paranoid. That was my first album.
I guess you win.
Amazing record.
Well, I'm a lot older than you guys, man. All right, Nick, first concert.
first concert was also Green Day for their 2005 American Idiot Tour at the Allstate Arena.
That must have been amazing.
That was first concert.
Yeah, that's a great first concert. That's great, a great first concert. Life. Yeah, I bet. All right, Dave, what about you?
You're going to do me dirty like this? It's Dream Theater.
Dream Theater, yeah!
Wait, which show was it? I might have been there.
I was 14 years old. Was it at Allstate?
Yeah, was it the Systematic Chaos Tour?
Yeah.
Listen to these guys talking
that,
Dream Theater here.
NADS thing. They do like a North American Dream Squad video.
What year was it?
It must have been like, I was 14, so like 2008.
Yeah, I was there.
All right. Evan?
The Bon Jovi Bounce Tour.
I don't even know
what to say to that. I can tell you mine was Black Oak, Arkansas. Do you guys know who that band is? Jim Dandy to the Rescue. That was the only hit they had. Okay. But Bad Company opened for them before their first album, so nobody knew who they were. That's how long ago it was. Wow. So, all right, well, we're going to hear a song.
Okay.
It's called Warning. Tell everybody, you want to set it up real quick so we can play it?
Yeah, unrelated to Green Day's Warning. Also great, great song.
Not related
but we
at
make
all.
Jokes about it. So. this was very much co-wrote. Evan came to me with a part. He came to me with essentially what amounted to be like a progression and a lot of lyrics. And I listened to it and thought about it. And I was like, I want a whole other thing. This is going to blow up. And so that sort of sets the stage for this. This builds tension of repetition until it just sort of opens up.
The coda of the record is kind of like this segment that Dave kind of spearheaded the idea for. And we have this kind of hocketed guitar line that kind of moves between an acoustic riff and an electric riff.
Okay.
And you'll hear, if you're listening on a stereo system, you'll hear the kind of bouncing around that there is in the speakers.
All right,
and
cool.
Our vocals also play off against each other. There's call and response in multiple aspects.
This is the Phantom Broadcast, and it's a song called Warning. Phantom Broadcast. That's great stuff, guys.
Thank you so much.
That's terrific, man. Really, really good. Good luck with your Kickstarter campaign. People can go to phantombroadcast.com and give them some money. You guys are three quarters of the way there. You're 17 days away from the end of the Kickstarter campaign. So, Nick D fans, get out there and help these guys out. Upcoming show, Monday, August 12th, 9 o'clock at Shuba's. It's free. And, guys, pleasure meeting you.
Pleasure meeting you.
It was a lot of fun to talk to you, man. All right.
It's great being here.
Have a great morning, and we'll take a break. The news is coming up right after this.
So kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. Excuse me. That's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Tom, who requested that?
That was Dave K. Wanted to hear a little Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Okay, there you go. Kicking off two for Tuesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Yeah, we're going to be talking about the great sort of animal attack movies. That'll be coming up in honor of Crawl and in honor of... By the way, Evan from the band, he lives in Humboldt Park. We were talking about the alligator.
So, he's on full alert.
Yeah, full alert. And then we're going to talk about Amazon opened for business in 1995 yesterday. And we've got the most recognized brand logos of all time. So those are some of the things we're going to be jumping in here and getting your Two for Tuesday requests. And if you want to jump in right now, we're going to be talking about the craziest alternate endings to famous films. You know, a lot of movies had different endings. They were either filmed or they weren't filmed, but they were in the original scripts. And sometimes they film an ending, they test screen it, it doesn't work, they have to change it. We know that this is true, but we've got some really crazy alternate endings here for movies. And if you have a movie that you know had a different ending, we would love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. What were some of your favorite alternate endings to movies? 312-981-7200. This is from Collider.com, and we have a link on our Facebook page if you would like to read the entire article. It's right up there. Everything that we talk about on the show gets posted on the Facebook page, which is why you should like it and be there at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us now and check it out, facebook.com/Nick D Show. It says here, a lot of things can change when you're making a movie, even the ending. New inspiration, poor planning, test audiences, or just one person saying, this is a bad idea, can change a creator's mind on how to finish off their story. We've gathered together some of the more intriguing alternate movie endings out there, including some that might be better than the ones we saw in the theater. Your favorite movie might have originally had a totally different ending, which is true for a lot of movies. 312-981-7200, but we got a bunch of them here. Some of these I'm already, you know, I'm familiar with. Some I'm not. Rocky Balboa, for instance. This movie sees a 50-something-year-old Rocky, played by Sylvester Stallone, come out of retirement to face a younger current champion, Mason the Line Dixon, which is the most ridiculous name ever.
A man named after a geological marker.
But Mason the Line Dixon. Rocky goes the distance, proving that he's still a contender. However, the film's alternate ending added more gold to Rocky's golden years. In Rocky Balboa's original ending, Rocky beats Dixon and becomes the world champion once again. While it would have been cool to see the Italian stallion wearing a title belt for one last time, it was ultimately decided to have Rocky's victory by him going toe-to-toe with the world champ without quitting. That would be the victory. You know, that was a surprisingly good movie.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was going to be good. You know, when I heard that he was making, I was like, come on, man. All right, how about this alternate ending here for my best friend's wedding? My best friend's wedding is a favorite rom-com from among rom-com fans. Julianne, played by Julia Roberts, tries to break up her best friend's wedding in the hopes of marrying him herself. In the original ending, Julianne fails to ruin the nuptials, but meets an interesting new guy at the reception, and the test audiences hated it. People didn't think that Julianne got her proper comeuppance for nearly ruining her friend's wedding for totally selfish reasons. So the ending was changed to Julianne dancing with George, played by Rupert Everett, her gay best friend, and not meeting any new romantic prospects. Yeah, I had a difficult time with that movie because she's so unlikable. Like, so unlikable. And I can't stand my best friend's wedding, even though it was shot here. But she's just a kind of a despicable character.
I was stuck watching that on a plane once.
Ugh.
It was really just not good.
No, it's not.
It was a long flight too. I was just like, I gotta have something on.
That's how I. That's how I. I've seen the one whole episode of Friends. Was I was stuck on the tarmac at LaGuardia. Of course, LaGuardia, which is the sorriest excuse for an airport in the world. We were stuck on the tarmac. We were just like sitting there waiting for a gate to open. And we were sitting there for like an hour and a half. And so one of the flight attendants popped in a video cassette of Friends. And I was trapped. It was the, you know.
It's like death by a thousand duck bites.
It's ridiculous. How about this? Army of Darkness had an alternate ending.
Yeah.
After traveling to the past and defeating the army of the dead in the Middle Ages, Bruce Campbell recites an incantation that takes a sleeping potion that allows him to wake up back in his own time. The original ending, however, was much darker. Instead of waking up back in his own time, Ash sleeps too long, waking up in a desolate future. Director Sam Raimi was pressured to shoot a happier ending for American audiences as Universal thought it was too much of a downer. That's how they end Ash versus Evil Dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Mad Max territory.
There's like four different versions of that movie, too, right? There's
Army of Darkness?
Yeah, theatrical, the director's. And I think I accidentally popped in the director's cut one time, and I forgot that was the original ending. That was and I was like, wait, I don't remember this part.
Yeah. Well, they got to do it, though. I mean, because like Ash versus Evil Dead's got that futuristic. It ends very futuristically, and it's total Mad Max Ash. At the very end.
And it's great.
It's awesome. I Am Legend. The only bad part of that movie is the ending. I actually like that. That's one of the only Will Smith movies I like. I can't stand Will Smith movies. He's maybe 6 Degrees of Separation, and I pass I Am Legend. I give it a pass, but that's about it. And, well, the first Men in Black. Will Smith saving the world? Check. Vampire-like mutants? Check. I Am Legend stars Smith as Neville, a man living alone in a post-apocalyptic city and working to discover a cure for the infection that has wiped out most of the population. He heroically sacrifices himself to destroy a bunch of mutants so two other survivors can escape with the cure. The original ending was much less action hero-ish. Neville realizes that the mutants just want to live peacefully and that to them, he's the monster. He and the mutants share a truce and Neville able to deliver the cure to the human colony himself, to the human survivor colony himself. Yeah. I don't know. It's both of those endings are not the ending to the book, though. So,
no.
maybe you should have done the original, you know.
I forget. What the ending to the book, does he become a vampire?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It's got a dark ending. But at the end, the ending that they have for I Am Legend now is pretty ridiculous. Because, like, they have the whole medical facility in the future is named after him and all that. So it's like, come on, man.
Yeah. Didn't work for me.
No. Still, lots of great stuff in that movie.
Sure. I mean, it was very tense. You know, Will Smith gives a great performance. I think the opening is really unsettling because it felt very honest. It felt very real. Some sort of pandemic breaks out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I'm a sucker for post-apocalyptic movies. I really am. I mean, you know, I've only seen Fury Road like 7,000 times.
And that's the post-apocalypse we should all be hoping for.
Well, please, man.
It's going to be great.
Polecats? I want some polecats.
Nitro trucks?
That's right. All right, if you guys want to jump in here, if you have alternate endings to movies or your favorite movie had a different ending, 312-981-7200. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you, man?
All right.
Yeah, this is definitely a legendary. I understood the ending, but I'm glad they changed it because if it didn't, we wouldn't have this iconic franchise that became so inspirational, Rambo, First Blood.
Yeah, First Blood, have you seen the ending where he dies?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I prefer that ending, quite frankly, because it works emotionally in that movie. Now, granted, you know, the Rambo franchise went on and on and on, but I think it would have worked better if Rambo died at the end of First Blood. And I've seen the ending, and I think it works so much better than the other one.
But, yeah, I understand, but still, it's Rambo, so you can't kill Rambo.
Yeah, okay. All right, Ike, take care.
No problem.
All right. Yeah, you can't kill Rambo. There's another movie coming out.
Well, that's Last Blood.
It's called Last Blood.
I'm in for that.
I don't know, man. Well, look, I was like real skeptical of the one from 2008 where he kills like 75,000 people in an absolute bloody fashion, but I enjoyed it. First Blood, the original ending, Rambo dies in the original ending, and it's it works. It's great. I've said this several times on the show. I think First Blood is absolutely the best movie that Sylvester Stallone has ever made, and I think it's the best performance he's ever given. Like, it's, you know, like the other Rambo movies are silly and that stuff blows up and he screams and, you know, kills a bunch of people. But First Blood is like a legitimately really a really good movie.
Do you think his performance in First Blood is better than in Creed?
No, he's amazing in Creed, and he should have won the Academy Award.
I think it's a hard choice.
It is hard, and also, I mean, he's great in Copland too. He's been good in a lot. I think he's especially good in Copland because it's not the kind of performance that you would expect from mm-hmm. Sylvester Stallone. Mm-hmm. The thing about his performance in Creed is that there is so much history and love for that character. He's such a beloved character. To see him come back like that and have that emotional arc that he has in that movie. Now, you know what the thing is? Mark Rylance, though, in Bridge of Spies is really good. He's really good.
And he is he's an actor of the highest order.
Yeah.
You know, he's a consummate professional. But not saying that Sly isn't, but...
It should have gone to Stallone that year. He should have won. Yeah, that, you want to talk about it? That's another movie that surprised the hell out of me. Creed? Oh, my God. I did not expect that movie to be not even a quarter as good as it was.
I was cheering.
Oh, it was great. I saw it twice in a week. I thought Creed was great. And I like Creed, too. But I thought Creed was really great. In fact, I think Creed's the second best Rocky movie.
I think you'd be honestly correct.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, just legitimate quality movie.
Absolutely.
The other ones have, like... I feel like a lot of nostalgia gets into it, and
yeah.
It's got fun characters.
Listen,
of course,
I have a soft spot in my heart for the third one. I love the third one.
Clubber Lang,
Thunderlips, the slow motion running on the beach, the homoerotic running on the beach with their half shirts on, with him and Apollo Creed jumping up and down in slow motion on the beach. The Eye of the Tiger. That movie rules. It's ridiculous, but it rules. So. All right, let's take a break here. When we come back, we've got more alternate endings, crazy alternate endings to movies. Some of these are kind of unbelievable. And if you have a movie that you really love that you know had a different ending, you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning. I'd a hammer in the evening all over this land. I'd a hammer out of danger. I'd a hammer out of
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Tuesday, so two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. Meet more Peter, Paul, and Mary. You get your requests in. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. We are talking about some of the craziest alternate endings to famous movies, and if you would like to jump in with your thoughts on this, 312-981-7200. 312 area code texts in, and you can text as well, 312-981-7200. Get Out has an alternate ending. I did not know that.
Yeah.
In the alternate ending, Chris is caught by the cop that pulled him over at the beginning, and he ends up in prison. Really? Is that like on any of the special editions? Is there?
Yeah, no, it's on the DVD release.
It is.
And it's a great scene. It very much changes like the vibe of everything that happens.
Yeah.
Because I forget what his... I know he's played by Lil Rel.
Yeah.
But his buddy Lil Rel comes and visits him in prison. And he's just like, "Nah, dude, we can get you out of here." He's like, "Why? You know, we can get you out of prison." And Chris just looks. He's like, "No. No." He's just like, "I'm going to stay in here." And it's really strange. And Jordan Peele, he wanted to use that one. It's shot, it's completed, it's like it's a regular scene from the movie, but he felt that he couldn't put Chris through all of that and the audience through all of that and not give him at least a win.
Yeah. I have not seen the alternate ending to that. 630 area code texts in Fatal Attraction, which is mentioned, obviously. This is an infamous one. Fatal Attraction, Dan, played by Michael Douglas, has an affair with Alex, played by Glenn Close, but things spiral out of control when Dan tries to break it off. Alex gets more threatening and unhinged until finally killing herself and framing Dan for her murder. At least that's what happened in the original ending. Personally, we think that ending is better because it was more in line with the psychological terrorism Alex inflicts on Dan for most of the film. Producers felt the ending was too grim, however, so they changed it to the one that's in theaters where Alex breaks into Dan's house, attacks him, only to be shot by Dan's wife, Beth, played by Ann Archer. The original ending works so well. You know, she kills herself with a knife, slits her own throat, and his fingerprints are on the knife. He gets framed, he goes to jail, which I think is the comeuppance that that character deserves. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about Fatal Attraction here. You can't really... There's no pulling punches through most of that movie.
But audiences hated Glenn Close's character so much that they wanted to see her die. And I totally, you know... I think Fatal Attraction is a good movie, but I hate that ending. I hate it. Like, she deserves to die? Okay, what about him? Doesn't he deserve to have some sort of punishment? He had an affair. Cheated on his wife. He got a family. Yeah, jail. All right, real quick, here's Mark the Bread Man. Go ahead, Mark.
Morning, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
I got a movie near and dear to my heart, Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
The alternate ending where Ken shoots himself, and then Francine throws herself into a helicopter blade.
Right. Yep, and that was the original. Yeah, Ken Foray kills himself, and then she throws herself into the blade, kills herself too.
Yeah, definitely would have been a very dark ending.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love though when he's sitting there contemplating it in the cut that we have now. When he's sitting here contemplating it, and then he decides not to do it, and that fantastic heroic music busts up on the score.
Oh, it's like yeah, it's the best thing up.
It's fantastic. All right, Mark, thanks, buddy.
All right, have a good one.
You too. It is such a great movie, man. God.
Unbelievable. Another one with like three or four cuts.
Yeah, bunch of different cuts on that one. All right. All right, let's take a break here. The news is coming up right after this.
I was born in the wagon of a traveling show. My mama used to dance for the money they'd throw. Mama would do whatever he could. Preach a little gospel. Sell a couple bottles of Dr. Blue.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we are talking about movies that had crazy alternate endings. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking about animal attack movies in honor of Crawl. But now we've got these crazy alternate endings for famous movies. And if you want to jump in with yours, 312-981-7200. Okay, let's see. In 630 area code says, in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Island of Misfit Toys, Santa and his reindeer don't stop at Misfit Island to pick up the toys. What?
I guess that's an alternate ending.
All right. 847 area codes. The movie Clue had three different endings. The theater only showed the third one. Multiple people killed various characters. Total crack up. Fabulous cast. Yeah, here was the deal. This was the deal with Clue. When Clue came out, which is a movie that I know a lot of people love. I don't get it. It's a great cast. Madeline Kahn was never not awesome. Taken from us way too soon. One of the greatest comedic actresses that has ever graced any kind of screen, ever. And Tim Curry rules. Tim Curry steals that movie. He's the best part of the movie. Have you seen Clue?
Yeah, I've seen it a couple times. Because
I mean, it's fine.
It was very popular amongst the theater kids when I was in high school because they were Tim Curry heads. Like,
yeah.
They were like, this is great. Oh, and look, it's got different endings. And I thought it was funny.
It's, you know, it's fine. I mean, but I know people who really love it. But here, this was the campaign when that movie came out. When that movie came out, the idea was to have the three different endings and to show there was ending A, there was ending B, and ending C. So the idea was that you go see ending A at whatever theaters are showing ending A, whatever theaters are showing ending B, and whatever theaters are showing ending C. They thought, I believe Paramount released the movie, they thought that, oh, people are going to go pay to see this movie three times to see the three endings. That didn't happen.
No.
So, but the idea was to get them to entice people to go, well, I saw ending A and it was awesome, but I want to go back and see ending B. And then we'll go back and it did not work. But yeah, that's what they did. That's what they were hoping for, repeat business. And when it came out on video, when they finally showed it on cable, they just showed all three endings.
Mm-hmm.
For us critics, because they screened it for the critics, we got to see all three endings.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was a real weird. I thought it was just a really weird idea.
Yeah, because it doesn't change the rest of the movie, really.
No.
So if you go and see it. And you're just like, ah, this is fine. Going and seeing, I don't see how the other outcomes would make the rest of it more interesting. You know what I mean?
No, yeah. I mean, you got to sit through 90 minutes before the ending.
Right.
And so it's going to be the same 90 minutes that you sat through twice before if you want to see that third ending. So when it came out, like I said, when it came out on video and cable, they just put all three endings at the end. That's how, if it comes on now, if you get it on DVD, that's what's, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just thought that was a very weird,
an interesting idea.
Yeah, failed. Did not work. All right, now this I didn't know. Seven had a different ending.
Huh.
Seven had an alternate ending. The modern thriller hit Seven follows two police detectives, the retirement-ready Somerset, played by Morgan Freeman, and the hotshot new guy Mills, played by Brad Pitt, on the trail of a serial killer who commits murders inspired by the seven deadly sins. The killer ultimately murders Mills' wife to provoke Mills into shooting him, becoming the final sin, which would be wrath. Amazingly, the original ending to Seven was actually less dark. In that ending, Somerset shoots the serial killer, instead saving Mills from committing murder. When asked why he shot the killer, Somerset responds simply by saying, "I'm retiring." God, am I glad they changed that.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
You know, it's funny because Dan Shugru, my former producer, also a big fan of Seven, like, because it is a great movie, Seven. He actually, I think that the ending of Seven, the very final, like, the final speech that Morgan Freeman gives, as they take Brad Pitt away in the back of the police car. And then it ends with David Bowie, so the over the credits, which, by the way, the credits are rolled backwards, which I just think is, I still think that's the coolest thing ever. I don't know why, but I just love the fact that the credits roll from top to bottom. I don't know why. I think that's awesome. But anyway, I think it's a really depressing ending. I think it's a really, really depressing ending. But Dan sees it as hopeful, you know? And I guess I can see that, but it's still, to me, I don't know. I mean, I just
mm-hmm.
And I mean, everything about that movie, it just, this,
it's a downer.
What is wrong with humanity? I mean, like, that's you watch that movie and you're like, good Lord.
Yeah. that's out there with Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
In terms of movies I can maybe watch once a year.
Well,
maybe.
Seven, I watch Seven frequently.
Requiem
for a Dream I've not seen since the day I saw it in the theater.
Yeah. I watched it one time at 11 a.m. during finals week. And I just couldn't do anything the rest of the day. I was so depressed.
Yeah. Are you talking about Seven?
No, Requiem for a Dream.
No, I can't.
Seven just messes me up. because it's just, it's, I don't know if depraved is the word, it's pointing towards the depravity
of humanity. I mean, really, seriously, it's one of the bleakest portraits of humanity that's ever been put to film.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it.
Yeah, no, it's spectacular.
Alien had an alternate ending. A relentless alien life form invades a cargo ship, killing off the crew one by one, and only Ellen Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver, is left alive. She blows up the ship and escapes in a life pod, ejecting the alien out into space. At least that's what happened in the version we saw. Director Ridley Scott originally wanted the alien to kill Ripley. In the scripted ending, the alien tears Ripley's head off, makes its way to control room, and then mimics a human voice on radio to Earth. An executive threatened to fire Scott for even considering that ending, so it was nixed and a franchise was. Could you imagine if that was the end?
That's beyond not okay. That is, I don't like that. I also would have fired Ridley Scott.
Wow.
I would have been like, nah.
Wow. All right. First Blood, we talked about. Rambo dies at the end of the original cut. Clue, we just talked about. With all the different endings. Pretty in Pink. The classic teen rom-com Pretty in Pink is a coming-of-age favorite for anyone who spent time as a teenager in the late 80s or early 90s. The end saw Andy, played by Molly Ringwald, accepting an apology from Blaine, played by Andrew McCarthy, and attending prom with him with the blessing of her friend date Ducky, played by John Cryer. But that wasn't the original plan. In the initial ending, Andy realizes that she should have been dating her best friend Ducky all along, and they attend prom together as a couple. Test audiences soured on this idea, so the ending was changed and reshoots were scheduled to pair Andy up with preppy but kind-hearted Blaine. So they did. They do have that. That was, test audiences hated it, that she ended up with John Cryer.
Yeah, because Ducky has to, I'm not going to lie, top 10 most annoying movie characters of all time. I cannot stand Ducky. And really, no offense to John Cryer, I don't think I've ever seen a movie or television show that I've ever actually liked him in. Like, he's incredibly annoying in 2.5 Men, which I think
is an awful show. Yeah. I'm trying to think. I've liked John Cryer and stuff.
I have. Ducky, he's such a...
Yeah, Ducky doesn't bother me. But like, people wanted her to end up with Blaine. So here's what John Hughes did. So he changes the ending where she ends up with the preppy kid. But then he goes and he writes Some Kind of Wonderful. And Some Kind of Wonderful is a role reversal, sex reversal version of Pretty in Pink. A guy from the other side of the tracks in love with preppy girl. Best friend, you know, unique, weird girl, played by Mary Stuart Masterson, Watts. And so he corrected, because there were people who were mad that she didn't end up with Ducky in Pretty in Pink. There were a lot of audience members who were mad, and fans of the movie were like, she should have ended up with Ducky. So he's like, all right, I'll make another Pretty in Pink, essentially, because it's pretty much the same movie. But he'll end up with the friend, the goofy friend, or the outsider friend.
But I'll tell you, the most unbelievable thing about Pretty in Pink, that Molly Ringwald is Harry Dean Stanton's daughter.
Yeah. Yeah, Harry Dean Stanton's really good in that movie.
He's great.
He's good in everything. But
I can't believe he's even in it.
Yeah.
I can't believe that Harry Dean Stanton's like, yeah, I'll be in this teen movie.
Yeah. You have this scenario in my head of the fact that, like, he's got, like, a bottle of liquor in the toilet tank hidden from Molly Ringwald. And, like, he's sneaking off a bunch of hooch, drunk all the time. That's the way I feel. It's Harry Dean Stanton.
He's constantly disheveled.
Constantly. But it was funny because, like, years ago when we were talking about this with my producer from years ago, Andy Herman, we used to call him Toilet Tank Harry in that movie, because we would picture, like, he's got to have booze in the toilet tank, and sneaking off every time he goes in the bathroom, he takes a bunch of swigs of bourbon and then comes back.
Why do you hang out with that Ducky kid?
Well, he hangs out with them, but they hang out together by the cooler. They're sitting outside by the cooler.
So weird.
My ex-wife, Heather, loves Some Kind of Wonderful so much. It's like her favorite movie, like, ever. She knows it by heart. I'm not exaggerating. Like, every beat, every line, she knows it by heart. And it would be, sometimes there would be nights when I'd be like, let's pop in Some Kind of Wonderful so I can see, I could see you recite it. Because I was just always fascinated by it. And she did, every time we watched it, she got every line, every pause, everything right. Everything. She loves that movie. And, like, Watts is her favorite. Like, Mary Stuart Masterson is her favorite. I think Mary Stuart Masterson's great in that movie. I think Eric Stoltz is a little dull.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. And what's his name? Who plays Duncan? Why am I blanking on his name? Elias Koteas. Elias Koteas, who's a great character actor, been in a million things. Fantastic in Shutter Island, by the way. But he plays Duncan, and that's like my ex-wife's like favorite character ever is Duncan from Some Kind of Wonderful.
He's credited as just Skinhead.
His name is Duncan in the movie. He's just credited as Skinhead?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. Some Kind of Wonderful, 1987. Elias Koteas, Skinhead.
No, his name is Duncan. Duncan. That's not fair. He is a skinhead. He is a skinhead in the movie, but he's Duncan.
Yeah.
So, all right. Let's take a break here, and we'll come back. We got more crazy endings to movies that you might not know about. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Do you believe in life after love? I can feel something inside me say. I really don't think you're strong enough, no. Do you believe? Oh, welcome back, everybody. Two for Tuesday. Yeah. We didn't acknowledge who requested the share.
Yep, that's coming to us from... That's coming to us from Lisa.
Okay.
We'll share.
There's a share for you on Two for Tuesday. You mean Two for Tuesday? All right. Welcome back, everybody. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. Back to our conversation about crazy alternate endings to movies. And if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right, we got some more texts coming in. Let's see. Canadian Bill says, David Seltzer rewrote most of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. He had to rewrite the end. It wasn't working, but he was on holidays. They tracked him down on his way to in the boonies. He had to climb a telephone pole to talk to the telephone like Green Acres, and then he had to come up with a line, and he said his famous line. 301 area code says the William Castle film, Mr. Sardonicus pretends to let the audience vote on the ending, but only one ending was filmed. William Castle, the king of gimmicks. Sardonicus, by the way, was on a couple of weeks ago on Sven. 708 area code says Bourne Identity. I rented the DVD, a few different endings. The government captures Jason Bourne. And again, they captured him. They wouldn't have 45 sequels.
So. Including that terrible one with Jeremy Renner.
Yeah. So Return of the Jedi had an alternate ending. Return of the Jedi wrapped up the original Star Wars trilogy, but it is not without its critics. One of the largest criticisms is the ending, which features all of the main characters dancing to an elaborate victory on Endor as the Ewoks play music and sing. Fans felt the finale was too cheesy and might have interested to learn that it was a different, darker ending that was originally pitched. According to producer Gary Kurtz, Han Solo, played by Harrison Ford, was supposed to get killed off. The ending wouldn't have been... The ending wouldn't have seen the rebellion dancing with joy, but just scrambled back together by Princess Leia, played by Carrie Fisher, to continue the fight against the Empire, and Luke, Mark Hamill, would have walked off into the sunset with R2-D2 like a wandering samurai, or, as Kurtz told the LA Times, like Clint Eastwood in spaghetti westerns. Harrison Ford wanted Han Solo dead... I think even an Empire.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted Han Solo.
He wanted out.
He wanted out. He'd have to wait till 2015 for that to happen.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sorry if I ruined that for anybody, but, you know, The Force Awakens came out like 5 years ago. So, four years ago, 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, Pineapple Express had an alternate ending. I have no idea. The wild stoner action comedy ends with a huge shootout that is as over the top as it is hilarious. Seth Rogen, James Franco, and Danny McBride blast their way through a compound of villainous drug dealers. Then they go to a diner to nurse their wounds before getting picked up by to go to a hospital. It's a classic action buddy ending that almost went in a completely different direction. In the alternate ending, Rogen and Franco sit on a couple of barrels and smoke. Moments later, they're riddled with bullet holes like the title characters in Bonnie and Clyde. It's just as over the top as the rest of the movie, but the filmmakers ultimately decided killing their two main characters was a bridge too far. It's also possible that the sequence was intended to be an after-credits scene or a crazy DVD extra. I did not know that.
That would have been an interesting way to go.
Yeah. Scott Pilgrim versus the World. God, I hate that movie. The only thing Edgar Wright's done that I can't stand. It's the only thing Edgar Wright's done that I don't love, because I love everything else Edgar Wright's done. Edgar Wright's cult action comedy is a favorite among comic book and video game fans. After Scott Michael Cera defeats all of Ramona's evil ex-boyfriend, that's Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who, by the way, is a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. I love her. She was so good on the last season of Fargo, man. She was unbelievable. And she's in that Cloverfield movie with John Goodman. I love her, man. I think she's amazing. Scott restarts his romance with Ramona and apologizes to his ex-girlfriend, Knives, played by Ellen Wong, for treating her badly. However, that wasn't always the ending that Wright had in mind. In an alternate ending, Scott and Ramona decide to split up, and Scott gets together with Knives. This led fans of the graphic novel series to wonder which couple was better, if neither Ramona nor Knives should end up with the not-quite-mature Scott. 1408 had a different ending. Creepy Thriller. This is a really good movie, by the way. That's a really effective Stephen King adaptation. And one of my favorite Cusack performances. One of my favorite John Cusack performances. A Creepy Thriller starring John Cusack. 1408 follows a ghost hunter as he attempts to stay one night in a severely haunted hotel room. In the theatrical ending, Mike survives a destructive fire in the room, but not before recording the voice of his dead daughter on tape, proving the existence of an afterlife. But that's just one of a total of four endings. Two different endings have Mike die in the fire, publishing a posthumous book about 1408 and continuing to search for his daughter's spirit as a ghost. In the fourth ending, Mike survives and his wife hears their dead daughter's voice from the tape recorder. Depending on where you saw the movie, you could have seen an entirely different finish to the film. They released it? They released it. Oh, wow.
That's a little unsettling.
Yeah. That's a creepy movie, man.
Very much so.
I was surprised by how much I liked it. So, all right. Let's break, and then we'll talk a little bit more about alternate endings to movies, and we'll jump into also great animal attack movies in honor of Crawl. All right. That'll be coming up after the news. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on Tuesday morning, 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday.
Who requested that?
It's coming to us from Rasco, a little Fleetwood Mac.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. It's here on WGN, and we're going to get into some animal attack movies, the best animal attack movies. There's a ton of those, and that's because of Crawl. But we've got some other movie stuff that we've been talking about here about the alternate endings to movies. Some of them are really surprising and weird. Some of them we know. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. How about Terminator 2? T2 had an alternate ending. Terminator 2 Judgment Day is considered one of the greatest action movies of all time. However, the original ending was a little bit more cheerful and cheesy and left no room for additional sequels. The film jumps several years into the future in which Judgment Day never happened, and an older Sarah Connor, played by Linda Hamilton, looks proudly at her adult son who is serving now as a U.S. senator. What? Senator John Connor? Director James Cameron abandoned that ending for a more somber one in which the Terminator, played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, lowers itself into a vat of molten steel to destroy the microchip and prevent further Terminators. Then Sarah Connor gives a speech about the now uncertain future as she and John Connor, Edward Furlong, drive down a lonesome highway. Okay.
Great ending, though.
Senator.
Senator John Connor.
Come on, man. We were talking about great trilogy movies yesterday on the show, and the Terminator movies came up. And I still back the third one.
I know you do.
I still back the third one. The other ones are terrible. The other sequels are terrible. But
it's certainly not the worst one, that's for sure.
No, God, no.
No.
No. And I don't know about this new one, man.
It seems to be getting away from everything that made those two Terminator 1 and 2 really great.
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Just it looks so over the top. I can't believe Jim Cameron is allowing this.
Yeah.
But he's also making like 8 sequels to Avatar.
Right.
So
there was an alternate ending to A Star Is Born last year's A Star Is Born. There have been 4 versions of A Star Is Born, all of which feature the death of the male lead. In Bradley Cooper's 2018 version, Jackson Maine, played by Cooper, hangs himself in his garage after concluding that his alcoholism is getting in the way of his wife Allie's career, played by Lady Gaga. At least that's the ending we saw. In one of the earlier drafts, Jackson was going to commit suicide by swimming out to the sea to drown. As production was underway, the ending was changed to Jackson recklessly riding his motorcycle and dying in an accident, leaving the audience confused whether Jackson intentionally crashed or not. That's how Chris Christopherson drives off in a car.
Yep.
In the 76 version. And then ends up in a crash. So, I mean, that it could be like, oh, did he die of an accident or did he purposely do that?
Yeah, I was going to say.
He was boozing while he was in the car, so.
Yeah. When I watched the 76 version, I don't know if they made it super explicit that he had killed himself.
Yeah.
Although it was kind of implied that it was one of those road to ruin sort of things.
Yeah. Man, I saw that movie so many times. It's one of my mom's favorite movies of all time. And that soundtrack, I know every song off that soundtrack. Every single song.
It's my favorite version of it.
No.
What, Babs and Chris Christopherson?
That's your favorite version of A Star Is Born?
Yes.
Wow, man. Wow. Judy Garland, dude.
Oh, she's great.
I mean, I've seen the 76 version of A Star Is Born 19,000 times because of my mom. And I like it. I like Bradley Cooper's version better than the 1976 version. I was surprised at how much I liked that movie. Because I wasn't expecting, because I'm not a Lady Gaga fan at all. But I think she's great in the movie.
She is great. It's Bradley Cooper I'm not super sold on.
Oh, I liked him. I thought he was good, and I thought he directed the hell out of the movie, too. Oh, that was a great directorial debut. And he can sing. How the hell did that happen? When did that happen? He used to be just the douchebag from the Hangover movies. Now, like, he's a really terrific actor, you know, working with guys like David O. Russell and then directing his own movies and, like, giving really strong performances in movies.
Listen,
now.
I am big into Bradley Cooper, especially in American Hustle. I thought he's so good.
Phenomenal.
He's
in
great
in American. Everybody is great in that movie.
Actors I don't even like all that much are great in that movie. But I just wasn't sold on A Star Is Born. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying.
Man of Steel. Who cares if there was an alternate... There was an alternate ending to Man of Steel. This take on the origin story of Superman has been debated among superhero fans and critics for years. In Man of Steel, Superman, played by Henry Cavill, kills nemesis Zod, played by Michael Shannon, by snapping his neck. Granted, Zod was about to kill civilians with his heat vision, and Superman felt like he had no choice, but it rattled audiences who felt that Superman shouldn't kill people no matter what. Superman killing another person didn't just cause arguments among fans, but it also Within the production of Man of Steel. Producer Christopher Nolan was against it, believing Zod should get banished instead of killed. After convincing convincing from director Zack Snyder and getting permission from DC, Nolan approved the neck snap. I don't even remember.
Yeah. I just would say they should have gone with the Superman 2 thing where they put him in the little thing.
Like,
yeah, that flips around.
Yeah. How about Star Trek Generations? It featured the long-awaited on-screen team-up of James T. Kirk and Jean-Luc Picard. The ending of the film sees Kirk sacrificing himself to distract the evil Dr. Soren, played by Malcolm McDowell, long enough for Picard to prevent Soren from destroying the entire solar system. The original ending was less impactful. Kirk gets abruptly shot in the back by Soren, which many involved in the production felt was a weak way for such an iconic character to die. Test audiences agreed, and the studio ordered rewrites and reshoots to give Captain Kirk a more meaningful death scene. He gets two death scenes in that movie because he's Shatner. He gets two death scenes.
I should have given him a third.
How about this from last year, your favorite? No, this one's not your favorite. The Predator.
Oh, yeah, no.
I like this one more than you did.
I still like, I own it. I have all the Predator movies. Yeah, God knows why.
Yeah. No, seriously, God knows why. The soft reboot of the Predator franchise was heavy on action and comedy, pitting the alien hunter against a team of misfit soldiers. At the end of the film, the soldiers defeat the Predator, and military scientists discover a Predator killer suit in a spaceship that could even the odds for humanity. Several different endings were suggested that would have connected the film to other franchises. The first ending, pitch, saw the surviving soldiers get recruited by Arnold Schwarzenegger, but that was abandoned when Schwarzenegger declined to do a cameo. Another idea was to have Sigourney Weaver appear as her character Ripley from the Alien franchise. Why?
That would have been embarrassing, but if Arnold Schwarzenegger had come out of that suit at the end, it would have been my film of the year. I would have lost my mind.
Clerks. Well, we all know the original ending of Clerks. I can't believe that was the original ending of Clerks.
It's bold.
Kevin Smith's breakthrough film follows Dante Hicks, Brian O'Halloran, as he gets called into work at a convenience store on his day off and tries to find direction in his life between conversations about Star Wars. The film ends with his friend Randall, Jeff Anderson, tossing Dante his sign and saying, "You're closed." At least that's the ending we saw in theaters. In the original cut, the ending scene continues with Randall leaving an unknown customer coming into the store. And after Dante explains to the customer that the store is closed, the customer shoots and kills Dante, then proceeds to raid the cash register. Under the advice of movie producer John Pearson, Smith cut the film earlier to keep the mood light at the end. That's crazy.
Did you see he's going to do a live reading of the unproduced Clerks 3 script?
No.
Yep. Since that's never, I don't think it's ever going to happen, but they'll just read it out loud.
Quiet Place had an alternate ending. I didn't know this. John Krasinski's direct, by the way, they've started filming Quiet Place 2. How?
Is it like a direct sequel, like the same thing?
I don't know. John Krasinski is directing it. I know that much. He can't be in it. He got killed in the first one. Didn't mean to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen A Quiet Place, but John Krasinski's directorial debut, A Quiet Place, was a home run for a first-time director. The story of a family surviving silently among an invasion of alien predators with super hearing was a hit at the box office, yet we wouldn't have gotten the hopeful ending of the film without Steven Spielberg. In an interview with The Hollywood Reporter, Krasinski shared that one of his producers recommended at the film that with Emily Blunt's character successfully killing one of the monsters rather than have the bleak ending Krasinski originally intended. He was against the idea until he listened to an old interview with Steven Spielberg in which Spielberg argued that you can have an artistic film that you can also eat popcorn to. With that in mind, he approved the change, knowing it wouldn't compromise his artistic take. I love the final shot of A Quiet Place. I love that final shot. Oh, here's one. Blade Runner.
which ending?
There's 45 different cuts on this movie. And they're all good, by the way. The sci-fi classic Blade Runner, about a man hunting four human androids called replicants. has so many alternate endings and cuts that fans have argued over which version of the film is the official for over 40 years now. The U.S. theatrical release had Deckard, Harrison Ford, and Rachel Sean Young leaving Los Angeles with a voiceover explaining that Rachel didn't have the four-year lifespan limit that the other replicants had, allowing the audience to enjoy a happier ending. However, in the other re-releases of the cuts and cuts of the film ends more ambiguously, with Deckard and Rachel leaving on an elevator with their fates unknown. Additional scenes were added that made people question whether or not Deckard is a replicant himself. Although that question was ultimately solved by... No, it wasn't. Solved by the sequel Blade Runner 2040. No, it wasn't. It was not answered in 2049. You still don't know if he's a replicant or not.
I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I watched
They do not answer that question. It's still up in the air. He could go either way.
Yeah.
I think he's a replicant. I've always thought Deckard was a replicant.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's kind of like, it almost kind of doesn't matter at that point whether or not he is. It's all about the fact that they were able to have a child regardless. Because we know that Rachel was a replicant for sure.
Little Shop of Horrors, when I screened that at my film club, I showed the alternate ending. I had the cut with the alternate ending where
Seymour takes over the world.
No, not
or,
Seymour.
Sorry, not Seymour.
The plants.
The plants. Yeah.
Yeah. They all they all grow like to get Godzilla size, yeah. And then there's it's like 10 minutes of mayhem. That's how it ends. They destroy the entire world with like great miniature use, and you know it's fantastic. Lion King. Did you know the Lion King had an alternate ending?
I did not.
Lion King has spawned a Broadway adaptation and a live-action remake, but it originally had a very different ending. During their final confrontation on Pride Rock, Scar tricks Simba and tosses him into a pit of fire. Simba lands safely on a tree, but Scar believes he's finally killed his nephew. He laughs maniacally as he's rapidly consumed by flames. Jesus, is that how it ends? That's how it ends?
Well, that's the alternate ending, I'm guessing.
Oh, Disney decided to change the ending, possibly because I've only seen Lion King once, and it was when it came out. Possibly believing it was too intense for children. However, altering Scar's fate, that he gets eaten by hyenas instead of burning alive, is a weird compromise. See, he gets eaten by hyenas at the end.
Yeah, you don't really see it, but yeah, because he uses the hyenas as his stooges. He's like, "Oh, I'm going to get you food and all that crap," and okay. then they end up eating him.
Well, there you go.
Take that, Jeremy Irons.
I wonder how the new movie's going to end.
Literally the same way.
Yeah.
Shot for shot remake.
Pretty much. Yeah. On the box office report on the show yesterday morning, Eric is predicting it's going to hit $200 million for the weekend.
I wouldn't be shocked.
Yeah.
So. Although I did think it was hilarious to look on Rotten Tomatoes and see that out of the two animal movies that will be, you know, competing, that the alligator attack movie has a higher tomato score than The Lion King.
That doesn't surprise me. Crawl is good, man. You saw it.
It's great.
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun.
It's fantastic.
I never would have thought that that would be the case.
An Alexander Aja movie gets a higher rating than a Disney film directed by Jon Favreau.
The guy behind one of the most depraved movies I've ever seen.
Yeah. All right, let's break here and come back and we'll wrap up this topic. One of my favorite Fleetwood Mac songs of all time. Love that song. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, 2 for Tuesday! Get your requests in now. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. If you want to join us. Coming up after 3:30, you know, this Gator movie that's out right now, I think it rules. I had a blast watching it. My parents loved it. And it was great. It's called Crawl, and it's a great example of animal attacking and killing humans. And that's a lovely, lovely subgenre that we're going to get into. And we're going to talk about the best animal attack, destroy human movies. 312-981-7200. We'll get into that. But right now we're going to wrap up the alternate endings to movies. Crazy alternate endings to movies. You got a few more here. Brazil. Which is really, truly one of my favorite movies. Terry Gilliam's dystopian film is considered a classic by science fiction fans. In the original theatrical release, the end of the film saw Sam, Jonathan Pryce, escape the fascist police in a truck driven by Jill, Kim Grace, presumably living happily ever after. However, that was not the ending that Gilliam had written or even filmed. You've seen the director's cut of this?
Yes.
So much better.
Oh, 100%.
It's so much better.
If you can get an original Terry Gilliam vision, get it.
Yeah. He's a filmmaker that has been hassled more than any filmmaker. He finally got that Don Quixote movie made,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty terrific.
And then they went, like, Amazon wouldn't release it
no,
for a while,
they did it, they
and then
did
they
it,
finally did.
Well, they released it at Fathom Events. It wasn't even, like, a regular release.
It was so dumb.
But seriously, he's had issues with almost all of his movies. Like, you know, getting his movies made the way he wants them made.
Yeah, he seems to have an uncompromising personality.
Oh, he does.
Especially, like, I watched a lot of, when we talked about the 50th anniversary of Python a couple weeks back, I was just like, well, I just have to watch all this stuff. There's a bunch of great documentaries, and watching him and Terry Jones talk about their difficulties working together.
Oh, yeah.
On Holy Grail.
Oh, yeah,
was
yeah,
fascinating, because they're both really creative guys.
Yeah. I got to meet Gilliam. He did a press tour for 12 Monkeys, and I got to meet him.
Oh, man.
And hang with him. He's amazing.
I could imagine.
Yeah, that's a great movie, too, 12 Monkeys.
I just wonder what goes on in that guy's head.
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be a total madhouse.
In the director's version, all of this happy ending imagery is revealed to be within Sam's mind. In reality, Sam was strapped to the chair and lobotomized, forever trapped in a state of ignorant bliss. Universal Studios were worried that the ending was too much of a bummer, so they re-edited it to a more crowd-pleasing finale without clearing it with Gilliam. They fought back and forth for almost a year before Universal finally relented and released Brazil with Gilliam's intended ending. Yeah, that's the way it's... I mean, it's got to end that way. The Jungle Book, from 1967, the original one. The Disney's animated Jungle Book ends with Mowgli becoming smitten with a girl in a nearby village that came to the river to fetch water. Then he leaves her and starts a new life in the man village. Yet when it was in the storyboard stage, the Jungle Book didn't have a new ending. It actually had a new entire third act. He would reunite with his lost mother at the man village. The story would then jump ahead in time, where he is now at odds with his animal friends. Wow. That would have been something. And then finally, Dr. Strangelove, considered one of the best satires ever made. Dr. Strangelove, terrifyingly funny look at the Cold War, takes on the mutual assured destruction of both the U.S. and Russia in the event of a nuclear war. The film concluded with the sight of Slim Pickens riding atop a nuclear payload like a cowboy, followed by footage of several nuclear explosions and the song We'll Meet Again as it plays on. Originally, the movie was going to end with a giant pie fight. Director Stanley Kubrick thought that the pie fight skewed the tone of the film too far from satire to screwball. Plus, the pies were so thick and flying so fast during the fight, it was difficult for people to visibly make out what was going on. Yeah, the pie fight, there's actual footage of the pie fight that you can see in the Criterion Collection of Strangelove, and there's actually like a ton of stills of them in the war room, because they have a giant pie fight in the war room. You can't fight in here. This is the war room. And as I've said before many times, the funniest performance in that movie, without question, is George C. Scott. And I know, and you know, Peter Sellers plays three roles. He's brilliant. Slim Pickens, everybody, but George C. Scott is unbelievably, it's one of my favorite comedic performances ever.
I forgot, what's he blathering on, the fluids? About the
No, that's Sterling Hayden.
That's Sterling Hayden, okay.
Yeah, Sterling Hayden. He plays Buck Turgidson.
Yeah. I can't get, the fluids are going to take us out.
Now, see, now that's Ripper. That's, he plays, Sterling Hayden plays Ripper. Buck Turgidson is George C. Scott, like slowly putting gum in his mouth nervously in the war room. He's unbelievable. You'll see the big board. He's so brilliant in that movie. All right, let's break here, and then we're going to talk Animal Attack movies in honor of Crawl. That's coming up. A jam. God, I love Pat Benatar. Who requested the Pat Benatar?
That's Scott from Streamwood.
Got good taste, Scott. Pat Benatar.
That's some intense Pat Benatar.
She rules. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. I saw Pat Benatar and many, many times. I've seen her like 5-6 times, but I thought it was appropriate that I saw Pat Benatar on my 40th birthday. That's how we spent my 40th birthday. We had a box. I had a friend. I have some friends who work at the House of Blues, so they gave me a box for my birthday, and me and four other people, my girlfriend at the time, we all went. It was fantastic. She's great. Pat Benatar's great, man.
I feel like I got robbed of some of the deeper cuts growing up, because it was always like the same three songs that would get rotated through class, and they're good songs.
Yeah,
but like I've never heard that before.
You never heard Promises in the Dark?
No, and that's awesome.
Oh, man. Have you heard Hell is for Children?
No, but that, you know, guess what? You just guessed the next one is.
Oh man.
So
those are two of her biggest jams. The Hell is for Children is an unbelievable jam.
Yeah. Oh man,
you got to go. You got to dig, man. I mean, she's Pat Benatar's. She's the deal.
Listen, I owe you baskets. I owe you. I'm in on Gilmore Girls now.
Good for you.
So that's happening. So next, I got to go in on Pat Benatar.
Oh, you got to go all in on Pat Benatar. She rules. So a band that I've discussed many times on this show, of course, the Fantastic Saga from Canada. A band that I adore that nobody knows except for Canadian Bill. I was obsessed with Saga. Saga opened for Pat Benatar one time. It was like one of the greatest nights of my life. First time I ever saw Saga, they opened for Jethro Tull at Poplar Creek. And I was like, ooh, these guys are awesome. And I've been a Saga fan since. I'm friends with Michael Sadler on Facebook. He's the lead singer.
Well, I think they're coming back around, I want to say,
they're
in the fall.
Playing the Arcata.
Yeah, playing the Arcata.
Yeah. Man, Saga.
Were you a Striper person as well?
No,
Christian hair metal for you?
No. Saga is like kind of prog rock, but not. It's kind of proggy rock.
Diet prog?
Yeah. I mean, they're only big. They only had like one. It was a pseudo hit. No one can stop us now.
Yeah.
Tonight we're on the loose.
You guys, I'm cracking up here because Tom mentioned Striper, and I've actually seen Striper in concert.
Yeah, you mentioned that before on the air.
There it is.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. If I mentioned it before, that time and this time was probably the only times I've thought about Striper in the last 40-30 years.
Well, I mean, didn't weren't you dragged along?
Yeah, yeah. It was some sort of a school thing. I can't remember why I had to go, but it was
Striper.
They were in the black and yellow.
Oh yeah,
you know,
the number is 777,
yes,
not 666.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Big things on the stage with 777. Yeah.
What school function?
Oh, it was a tiny
Striper.
Little town in New Mexico along the border with West Texas, a little tiny school that I went to. It was a little farm community that I lived in for a couple years.
There you go.
Wow.
Taking you out to see Striper.
Yep.
Striper.
They took us to see the Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah.
I'd rather seen Striper.
I didn't see anything when I was when I went to school. We used to go on some field trips, but we would, you know.
No Striper.
They never took us to see Striper.
New Mexico, molding the minds of young babes.
I saw King Tut's tomb, though.
Well, that's cool.
Back in the 70s when it was just like a, you know, was insane.
Mm-hmm.
I can see a little Nick DiGilio criticizing it right there in front of the
Oh, no, it was cool. It was cool. Yeah, the King Tut exhibit was amazing, and it was a phenomenon in the mid-70s. I mean, it was just crazy. You had to wait. People were waiting hours in line to see King Tut's tomb.
Yeah, it was back before the internet.
Yeah.
when we would wait hours for something.
You could just do a virtual tour online.
Yeah.
So, Striper. All right. Didn't they have an album or a song called To Hell with the Devil?
That sounds awfully familiar. That may
I think they did. I think they had either a song or an album called To Hell with the Devil.
Yeah, that the album released in 1986.
Yeah, of course.
It remained the best-selling Christian metal album till POD's Satellite in 2001.
I didn't even realize that was an actual genre. Christian metal?
Yeah, Christian metal. That was the tour that I would have went to then in 86. That would have put me around eighth grader.
To hell with the devil, man.
To hell with the devil.
Oh, man. You know, Slayer has one of my favorite album titles of all time. South of Heaven.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of my favorite album titles of all time. Oh, man. All right, well, there you go. We go from Pat Benatar, I don't know how, to Saga to Striper.
A little Striper talk.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right, well, welcome back, everybody. So they're bringing in a big gun from Florida. He's brought in to catch old Chance the Snapper. As we continue to do Gator Watch there in Humboldt Park. After 6 fruitless days of searching for an elusive alligator in the Humboldt Park Lagoon, the city announced it's bringing in an expert from Florida and shutting down part of the park in a stepped-up effort to trap the gator. The orders came from the top. Mayor Lori Lightfoot. The city's Animal Care and Control Department said it's grateful to have the Chicago Society for its assistance, but Alligator Bob is now going to come in and run, and he will be helping run the operation. Alligator Bob has toiled in the lagoon for 6 days, so now enter Frank Robb. So Alligator Bob's not doing well; he hasn't been able to find him. So they're bringing in Frank Robb from Florida. He is hired by Animal Care and Control to ensure a safe and humane capture of the alligator as well as to protect residents. He arrived on Sunday and immediately began assessing the park and the lagoon.
Just surveying it.
In addition, the Chicago Park District, Chicago Police Department, the Office of Emergency Management and Communications, Streets and Sanitation, Department of Transportation, and Illinois Department of Natural Resources are involved in, quote, making the park as calm and quiet as possible, which will increase the odds of successfully capturing the alligator. So we've got round two here, bringing in Frank Robb.
God forbid they have to get Amos Moses in there.
That's right. We'll throw him right into the swamp. So we have the elusive alligator, all right? And then, of course, in the theaters right now, we have the movie Crawl, which is about alligators eating people, which is all I wanted from that movie. So it's like I wanted some cool hurricane effects, and I wanted some alligators to eat people. And that's exactly what that movie is. But there have been a ton of animal attack movies, and we're gonna bust them out. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. What are your favorite animal attack movies? It's a great subgenre. One of my favorites, in fact. So, we've got these things busted up into little categories here. So we're going to chat here about the best movies where animals destroy humans. 312-981-7200. This is a fun topic. In honor of Crawl, what are your favorite animals attacking human movies? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. the last like minute and a half when this song kicks in, forget it. Bust every piece of furniture in the house. It's such a jam. Because it really like blows up. It really goes. It's a great song. Pat Benatar, 2 for Tuesday. She's no striper. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Coming up at 5, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. At 6, the great Steve Cochran with your morning drive. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And right now, in honor of the really fun movie that's out right now called Crawl, about alligators eating people, we're getting into the wonderful subgenre of animals destroying humans and animals eating people and animals attacking. And we would love to hear from you about your favorites in this fantastic genre. And if you have not seen Crawl, you should, especially if you like to watch alligators eat people. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Here is John on WGN. Hi, John.
Yes, another great alligator movie, Lake Placid, featuring Betty White saying a line I can't say on the radio, but if you go to YouTube and you just search for Betty White, Lake Placid, you'll get the classic line.
Yeah, well, yeah, she's got a filthy mouth in that movie. Yeah, so we got a weird connection there, John. But yeah, Lake Placid, classic alligator movie. Classic, and if I'm not mistaken, written by David E. Kelly, creator of many acclaimed television series, and married to the Michelle Pfeiffers.
Lucky?
Yeah, please. Here's Roger on WGN. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Nick, how's it going?
All right, what's up?
Calling from Manitoba again. Last week I gave you a top secret, and I gave you the burbs.
Okay.
But tonight for animal destruction, one of the best, most classics, the Night of the Lepus.
Yeah, Night of the Lepus is not just about animals attacking. It's about giant rabbits.
Bunny rabbits.
Yeah, gigantic rabbits that are bigger than cars running around killing people. Janet Leigh's in it.
Yeah, unless the bunny was attacking a person, and then he had to wear the suit, and then all of a sudden the bunny was the size of the person, and then he became the size of a house again.
Yeah, exactly.
The classic.
It is a classic. All right, Roger, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Nick.
Take care, man. All right. A 708 area code comes right out of the gate here with the first one that's in this article. And that's of unknown origin. Very rated animal horror movie. It's like Jaws, but with a rat. It's a great movie. A great movie. Have you seen Of Unknown Origin?
I have, yeah. It was after I went down the rabbit hole that is Ben and Willard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I need to see if there's more to the rat genre.
Well, this is the great work of the late, great George P. Cosmatos. Peter Weller is unbelievable in it, too. Peter Weller is fantastic in this refreshingly low-stakes animal attack movie pitting a businessman against a simple pregnant rat nesting in his home. Weller loses his grip and endangers his promotion at work by taking various steps to eliminate one very clever rat who's determined she's equally entitled to safe living quarters in New York City. Directed by the always interesting George P. Cosmatos, who did Tombstone and Rambo and Cobra and Leviathan. Of Unknown Origin doesn't try to keep its creature hidden, instead depicting it almost exclusively in extreme close-up. In 1983, film critic Vincent Canby wrote a very catty and dismissive review of the movie, though he makes a great observation that the persistent shots of the rat feel more intimate than scary, and that's probably true. It's like viewing the film under a microscope. The film's dialogue is essentially a litany of mostly accurate rat facts, so in keeping with this theme, Of Unknown Origin might just be too niche for most audiences. Stephen King is a professed fan, and the movie just hasn't received the kind of love that others have enjoyed. So, and it's a great showcase for Peter Weller. Peter Weller's really great in it.
I found the movie to be pretty frightening at times.
Oh yeah,
like the close-ups thing was really, because I hate rats. Mm-hmm. Like they really freak me out. And even some of my closest friends, they have pet rats, and they are so harmless, they would never hurt you, but they still freak me out.
Mm-hmm.
So anything rat-based.
Yeah. What is it? 763 area code. How about Kramer fighting with the monkey at the zoo? All right. Animals attack. The last story in Creepshow when the cockroaches devour E.G. Marshall. It's awesome. It's the best. It's the best thing in Creepshow. That last story in Creepshow is the most, without question, the most Romero-esque of all of the stories in Creepshow. Creepshow's a fun movie, but it doesn't, you know, it's fun and it's the stories are cool and I like the style and everything and it's a great cast. But it's not until that final episode where George Romero decides that he's going to make a George Romero movie. The themes, what it's about, the style. It's like, oh, that's right. George Romero did direct this movie. And not that I don't like the earlier stuff in Creepshow, because I do. I do. I like Creepshow. I think it's really fun. But that final episode is just, forget it. Nick, Doc says, in the annals of animal attacks, I can't help but think of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Tim cautions the others, that rabbit's got a vicious streak a mile wide. It's a killer. It's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you'd ever set eyes on. What is it? Who is Eric Idle? I soiled my armor. I was so scared. Yeah, the killer rabbit. That became just such a legendary scene.
What's it gonna do? Nibble me bum?
Yeah, so great. The runners up in the rat department here, according to the article, Willard from 2003. The remake is a bit better than Willard from 71. And but so is Ben, honestly. Add 7 minutes of Batman unspooling the case and Shirley Walker's score makes it feel like a feature-length episode of Batman the Animated Series. Deadly Eyes from 1982. I remember seeing this. I remember seeing Deadly Eyes at the Luna over on Belmont and Cicero, the old Luna Theater. I've told you about the Luna Theater, right?
Yeah, that was the Grindhouse.
No, this
is the one with the curtains.
Yes, the curtains instead of doors.
Yeah.
That's what set it apart from every other theater.
God, what I wouldn't give.
So ridiculous. Canadian horror icons Lisa Donaldson and Lisa Langlois take on a horde of rats, along with the shining Scatman Carruthers from the director of Enter the Dragon, Deadly Eyes. Rats, Night of Terror from 1984, another great one. And then Rat Boy, directed by Sandra Locke. Rat Boy is actually a good movie. It's not an animal attack movie. It doesn't fit into this category. But
it's loose.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a break here. And we got the news coming up, and then we'll jump right back into this conversation. In honor of Crawl, the alligator movie, we are talking about the best and the coolest animals attack, animals destroy humans movies, 312-981-7200.
Like I wanna be loved by you.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell coming up at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. And who requested the Jim Stafford? Oh, he's on the phone right now. So we'll find out who requested the Jim Stafford in a couple of minutes. So who requested the Jim Stafford?
Pardon me. Let me pull my little list here. That's coming to us from Steve.
Steve wanted to hear Jim Stafford. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's funny. It's appropriate that there's spiders and snakes, considering we're talking about animals attacking movies. Crawl, featuring a lovely, not just a alligator, many alligators, chewing on people. So we thought we'd talk about the wonderful animal attacks and animal destroy human genre. Which ones are the best? 312-981-7200. How about this? The best killer dog movies. They say The Pack from 1977 and Baxter from 1989. The killer dog genre is truly an embarrassment of riches. Even the more questionable entries like 1982's Mongrel may feature a knockout performance by Mitch Pileggi. Or in the case of Monster Dog, an entrancingly strange original song by Alice Cooper. Best in show, though, is probably the two-way tie between The Pack, in which the pet dogs abandon vacationers on Seal Island, Nova Scotia, and turn feral, and the incomparable Baxter. In Baxter, a bull terrier narrating his own story searches for an adoptive owner worthy of his possession. It's not a straight horror film or even a straight killer dog movie. Baxter only kills his original owner. But it's a great movie about the ethics of pet ownership and ones that features one of the all-time great TV movie spots. All right. So the attack, the dog attacking movie, how do you not just immediately go to Cujo? How do you even, because
that's like the prototype, right?
It's the gold standard of dog attack movies. Cujo's a really good movie.
It is.
And the performance by Dee Wallace is so great. It's like really one of the best horror performances ever. The kid's great too, but I mean it's an exhausting performance.
It's an exhausting movie.
I'd go.
You're drained by the end of it.
No, absolutely. I go right to Cujo. Cujo, they write here, says, still waiting for a great, accurate rabies movie. Though do see the first half of the BBC miniseries, The Mad Death. But the image of a snot-encrusted St. Bernard staring down Ed Lauder is gold. is golden. Way to bring up Ed Lauder. Here's Michael on WGN. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Hey, got a staple from Saturday afternoons on WFLD back in the day, Tacitus Killer Shrews with the legendary James Best.
Yeah, I haven't seen that movie in years. It's been a long, long time since I've seen that one, but yeah.
There was a network on Channel 38 not too long ago called The Works. They actually aired that film.
Wow, okay.
And I wish it was still on, because they actually aired a Doctor Who movie from the mid-60s with Peter Cushing as Doctor Who.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that Peter Cushing played Doctor Who. Peter Cushing played everybody.
Yep.
That's why he was the king. All right, Michael, thanks.
All right, take it easy, Nick.
Peter Cushing played Doctor Who in a movie. He played Sherlock Holmes. He played Van Helsing. Jeez. He played Dr. Frankenstein. He did Shakespeare.
Mm.
Peter Cushing, man. My hero. Let's see more. How about this one? Dogs. Oh, God, I remember this movie from 1976. Secret government experiments cause neighborhood dogs to turn on their owners. Stars David McCullum as a despondent college professor and features a truly great pre-credit sequence. I remember Dogs. White Dog. You ever seen White Dog?
No.
You got to see White Dog. Samuel Fuller. This is the plot. Are you ready for the plot of White Dog?
Okay.
Christy McNichol is in it, and she lives in the hills in California, and she comes across a dog, a white dog, and you know. Puts up signs that said it's lost, and then she brings it home. And by the way, Burl Ives is in the movie as well. He according to this little article, he does say that Burl Ives steals the show as a trainer who hates Star Wars, which is true. And Samuel Fuller, by the way, are you familiar with Samuel Fuller's work?
I am.
Shock Corridor, stuff like that?
Marginally familiar.
Okay, he was insane. Mm-hmm. He made insane movies, and brilliant and insane movies. So White Dog, which was banned, this movie was pulled off the market. It was banned, and it wasn't released until a few years. It sat on a shelf because the plot of it is this. Christy McNichol finds this white dog, but then it attacks an African-American guy. And then she discovers that the dog has been trained to attack black people. That's what the movie's about. Paul Winfield comes in to deprogram the dog.
Jeez.
It's insane. And it's also great. Like, it's a really, really great movie. Now, if you're looking to watch it, Tom, make sure you get Fuller's cut. Make sure you get the director's cut, because the movie was chopped apart by the studio, because obviously the subject matter is nuts. But it is a movie about race, and it takes it very, very seriously. It's also a great animal attack movie. And again, Burl Ives is great, Paul Winfield is great, and Christy McNichol is great in it too.
Apparently, there's a Criterion release that has the original uncut film.
There you go.
So.
That's the way to go.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, White Dog. It's classic. I mean, it's truly classic, and it is Samuel Fuller at his craziest. 765 area code Nightwing. About vampire bats. Nightwing, I remember that. It came out summer of 1979. It was often... I saw Nightwing a lot. You know why I saw Nightwing a lot? Because it was often double-billed with Phantasm. So when I was on my roll of seeing Phantasm over 100 times in the theater in the summer of 79, I would often go to double features. So I could see Phantasm, then whatever the double feature is, and then stay for Phantasm again. So that way, I would get to see Phantasm twice. And it was teamed up with a terrible comedy called Hog Wild, which is like an Animal House ripoff, but about bikers. And it was often teamed up with Prophecy, which is one of the worst movies ever. But I saw it multiple times. Anaconda with Ice Cube. Oh, that's a great movie.
Yeah.
That's a great movie. The only time I've ever liked Jennifer Lopez in anything.
And John Voight.
John Voight, unbelievable.
He's just...
like doing Scarface. He's doing like an imitation of an imitation of Al Pacino doing Scarface.
It's spectacular. Yeah. And Owen Wilson gets bumped off pretty quickly.
Yeah. I love Anaconda. I'm a fan of Anaconda.
It's disturbing, kind of. Yeah. Like, ooh.
And Cube, man.
Cube.
So... all right, let's break here for the miserable weather.
I come to my brother was there, and he said, "What's wrong with your eyes?" I said, "I don't know. I was chewing on the weed." He said, "Well, let me give it a try." I spent the rest of that day and most of that night trying to find my brother Bill. Caught up with him about 6 o'clock the next morning, naked, singing on the windmill.
Yeah. Jim Stafford, one of them storytelling singers. 2 for Tuesday, everybody. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich will come in at 5 with the opening bell. So we're talking about, in honor of Crawl, which is really a pretty terrific alligator attack movie, we're talking about animal attack movies and some of the best ones. And what are your favorites? 414 area code, that would be Steve from West Ellis, Wisconsin, says, the movie that really scared me when I was a kid was Grizzly from 1976. Yeah, Grizzly was one of those, because after Jaws came out, it was just any animal, animal attack movies just went through the roof in the 70s.
Orca, the killer whale.
Orca, yeah, with Richard Harris. Bo Derek's first movie.
Bo Derek.
Gets her leg bitten off. So there was just a slew of them. Grizzly was one of them. And my favorite story about Grizzly involves my friend Scott Oaken, who was at summer camp. And... he's about, was set in 1976, he's about 12 maybe, 11-12 years old, 11-12. He's at summer camp, and it's in the middle of the forest, and they decide that they're going to show a movie to the kids, and they show Grizzly. And this was, you could tell, it was one of those deals where it's like, okay, the counselors are clearly just screwing with these kids in the worst possible way, and they either don't like these kids or... they just want to play a really horrible, terrifying prank on them. So Yeah, they showed Grizzly, and Scott said the walk back to the cabin through the woods was the most terrifying thing that he's ever had to experience, because he had just seen this movie Grizzly, which much of it takes place in the woods, and much of it contains a giant grizzly bear ripping people to shreds. So I'm just picturing the counselors, like, blowing weed, you know, in the forest, laughing as these, like, 10, 11, and 12-year-old kids are completely freaking out while watching Grizzly at night in the middle of a forest. Ugh. 301 area code says, don't forget Alligator, written by John Sayles and directed by the same person who directed Cujo. It's a great animal attack movie. Alligator is the classic of all the alligator movies. We talked about Lake Placid. We've talked about other ones. And, of course, Crawl, which is a fun alligator movie and a really good one. But Alligator is that's the crown jewel of the alligator attack movies. Robert Forrester's in it. As you said, written by the great John Sayles. Fantastic. Let's see. Now we got back to, speaking of which, Robert Forrester stars in Louis Teague's Alligator. It's the unassailable entry in the genre, featuring a rogue alligator flushed down the toilet that grows into a monstrous proportion. Robin Riker plays a herpetologist, while Henry Silva is a big game hunter wheeled in to take down the killer reptile. There's even a massacre at a wedding. It is perfect. Yes, it is.
Good old Henry Silva.
He's the best, man. How about the other ones that are runners-up? Eaten Alive. Eaten Alive, if I'm not mistaken. Eaten Alive's Toby Hooper. If I'm remembering, a loose biopic of killer innkeeper Joe Ball, who fed his victims to gators behind his place. Neville Brand is creepy as the innkeeper, and William Finley's performance as an unhappy family man is terrifying. I'm pretty sure Eaten Alive's Toby Hooper.
Yeah, it is.
Lake Placid, we mentioned. Black Water from 2007, another fine entry from the open water school of killer animal movies. One crocodile, two potential villain to victims, and a tree branch to keeping them apart. And then The Great Alligator. From 1979, an unusual Italian film starring Barbara Bach that features a discussion on the merits of dying before turning 30 and a climax where dozens of elderly people are eaten. Jeez. Man. 312-981-7200. You got some favorite animal attack movies? I got a bunch here from the 779 area code. Anaconda, we mentioned already. Sharknado, all the Sharknado movies, those are ridiculous.
The producer of those follows me is on Twitter.
Why?
I don't know.
The producer of the Sharknado movies?
Yes, sir.
Eight-Legged Freaks. Oh, we got to get to the spider movies. Eight-Legged Freaks. Eight-Legged Freaks. I love Eight-Legged
Freaks.
It's
so funny.
I love that movie.
David Arquette's greatest performance.
I think it's great. Five-Headed Sharks. What the hell is that?
I know there's a three-headed shark movie. There's definitely a two-headed shark movie.
Five-headed sharks? Deep Blue Sea? Well, please.
Yeah.
One of that moment where the shark jumps up and eats Samuel L. Jackson is one of the greatest. I thought the theater was going to fall in. I saw it in Times Square in New York on a Friday night at a midnight in the middle of the summer of 1999, and I thought the whole place was going to explode when that happened. That's another movie I love. Unapologetically, I love Deep Blue Sea. Directed by Rennie Harlan, so it means I have to like it. Legally. Day of the Animals. Oh, one of the classics from the from that 70s era around the Orca the Grizzly time. Piranha. Piranha. Joe Dante. John Sayles. Great movie. Bradford Dillman. I love Piranha. I love that movie. I like the remake that Aja did, the Piranha 3D. It's not really a remake, but it's like a reboot.
Wasn't Jim Cameron's first movie a Piranha movie?
Yes, it was.
The Spawning.
That was his first movie. He worked for Corman. Like all those other filmmakers who would go on to like insane success. He spent the early part of his career working for Roger Corman, which is where you made movies. That's go ahead, make it. Go ahead, make the movie. I don't care. By the way, the Piranha 2 is terrible.
Oh yeah, no,
it's terrible. But the Joe Dante, the Joe Dante Piranha movie is great. It's really, really great. All right, more killer animal movies. Animals destroying humans as part of the celebration of the crocodile alligator movie there that's out there. Crawl. 312-981-7200. News is up after this.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel all right. You know I work all day.
All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell, and the great Steve Cochran at 6. He's got your morning drive. Who requested the Beatles?
So that is coming to us from Big Ed.
All right, Big Ed, there you go. Some Beatles. Hey, I mentioned earlier in the show that I'm hosting an outdoor screening of Caddyshack tomorrow night, Wednesday night, the 17th, and I hope you can all make it. It's not going to rain, and it won't be unbearably hot because the heat's not going to roll in until Thursday afternoon. The big heat's not going to roll until Thursday afternoon, so it's going to be pretty pleasant out there. It'll be under the stars, and it's the classic 1980 comedy Caddyshack, Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, Ted Knight. Just a legendary comedy. One of the greatest comedies of all time. And we're going to be watching it, get this, in the courtyard outside right next to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant in Rosemont, which is a really, really, really great place. We've partnered up with these guys for the past few months for our film club, and they've been really cool. The food is great. They've got a ton of drinks. Very, very cool place. And you get 15% off of all your food. So come on out to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant, which is located in the Crown Plaza Hotel. And we're going to be in the courtyard of the Crown Plaza Hotel right next to the restaurant watching the movie out on the big screen under the stars. And you can get 15% off your food, and they're also going to throw $10 extra. They'll put $10 on your bill. That's your admission. That's like your door charge for seeing Caddyshack. So you got questions or you want to make reservations, you can call the Caddyshack restaurant at 847-443-3673. Tell them you're with the Nick DiGilio Film Club and you're coming to the outdoor screening of Caddyshack. You want to make a reservation or talk, or you have any questions about it. It's going to be a lot of fun. This is the first time we've ever done this, an outdoor screening. And what I just want to mention really quickly, that the theater that we use for my film club is currently under construction. The whole second floor of the AMC Rosemont Theater, Rosemont 18, is being redone, and they're putting in the leather recliners and all that cool stuff, and they're going to make the auditorium, you know, they're going to upgrade the auditorium. And so that's the only theater that we use there. We want to use the big, beautiful Premier Theater. That's where we want the best possible facility when we show our movies. So we're not going to be there here or in August at the theater. We'll return in the fall, probably in September, with a brand new Premier Theater on the second floor. So that's why we're doing this outdoor thing instead of being at the AMC Rosemont Theater. So once again, the Crown Plaza Hotel is in Rosemont. The Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant is right there. The parking is free. Get your ticket validated and you're all set. And then the movie's going to start around 9, right at dusk. I'll do an introduction, and then we'll all watch Caddyshack, the classic comedy of all, one of the classic comedies of all time, on the big screen. And there you go. So if you want to, again, call to ask questions or to make reservations or to make sure that you're going to get in there, have some dinner at Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant, and then see Caddyshack outside right next door, 847-443-3673, 847-443-3673, Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant in Rosemont. Call, make reservations, get your questions answered, and we'll see you tomorrow night, Wednesday night. Get there for dinner, 15% off, and then we'll watch the movie afterwards starting at dusk around 9 o'clock. It's going to be a blast. I can't wait to see it outside on the big screen. It'll be great. So 312-981-7200 movie is what we're talking about. And because of the crocodile movie, or the alligator movie, sorry, there's a difference, alligator movie, of course, we're talking about Crawl. We are talking about the best animal destroy human or animal attack human movies. Here's Tony on WGN. Hi, Tony.
Yo, Nikki, what's going on, man?
How you doing, man? All right.
Hey, man, I'm still breathing. Maybe that's what counts.
There you go.
Hey, man, what about the Food of the Gods, Nick?
Food of the Gods. Absolutely crazy movie from the 70s based on the H.G. Wells story.
Exactly.
Marjo Gortner is the lead in it, and it's just basically a bunch of animals they drink. So there's like a corporation that's dumping poison into the water, and animals are drinking it, and they're getting huge. So there's giant rats running around. There's a giant. My favorite is the giant chicken. That's my favorite. Is when the guy goes into the barn, and there's a giant chicken in the. Yeah. Classic. Saw that one in the 70s many times. All right.
Oh, yeah, man.
All right, Tony. Thanks, buddy.
All right, man.
All right. Hey, by the way, Tom, have you seen the footage of the New Jersey Devils mascot going through a window at a school?
No.
Why? He's at a school with a bunch of kids. He's running around. He runs into the window, shatters the entire window.
Oh. Oh, no.
It's hilarious.
Oh, my
God.
And then
he got into the New Jersey Devils fan van and brought another sheet of glass to replace the window that he shattered.
So I really think that might be the weirdest part of the story, is that he just happens to have another sheet.
No,
of
he
glass.
Went out and got one.
Oh, he went out and
yeah,
got one.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I thought he just had it on hand.
No. He wanted to make up for smashing through. He went right through the window. He smashes right through the window. It's so funny, too, because the guy's in a full-on devil mascot costume. And after he goes through the window, he just like shakes his head and puts his head down in that mascot fashion.
He's got to stay in character.
The entire pane of glass was shattered. And you know I love my mascots and mascot antics, and just to see the New Jersey Devils mascot go through a pane of window at a school with a bunch of kids in the room.
Yeah, man, go Devils.
Oh, and the whole thing just shatters. It's out there on the intranets, and it's very funny. Actually, somebody posted on my Facebook page earlier this morning because they know my love of mascots. It's just so funny. After the window shatters, he just puts his head down, kind of shakes his head like, oh, no. Oh, man. Are you watching it now, Tom?
Yeah.
Did he go through the window already?
Hold on. He's playing the parachute game with the kids.
Yeah. Did he go through the window? It's classic, right? That's the video. Oh. That's the video of the day, man.
Oh my God!
Yeah, New Jersey Devils mascot smashing through a window pane at a school while entertaining children.
Yeah, the kids seem pretty nonplussed. They're just kind of like, oh wow.
But you know what? He probably thought. You know, he probably thought that it was like the glass on the boards.
Sure.
On the ice. That's probably what, because like, those are very strong. He could slam into it. So maybe he thought he could do that. All right.
Dummy.
Best killer pig movie, Razorback. I love this movie. You ever see Razorback?
No. I wasn't aware that there was a killer pig genre.
Oh, it's fantastic. Russell Mulcahy, he directed it, who directed Highlander. Razorback is great. A very stylish Australian movie about a wild Razorback boar. How about the best killer bear movie? They say Prophecy. Which is a terrible movie. An enormous bear mutated by mercury begins slaughtering campers in Maine. Backcountry. This is a recent movie. Excellent recent film about a couple who probably should have never gone camping, featuring some intense special effects makeup. According to this, it came out in 2014. I don't know about this movie.
What's it called again?
Backcountry. One word. Backcountry. Grizzly, of course. You can't. That's the killer bear movie. It's not Prophecy. All great killer bear movies begin with Grizzly from 1976, classic from director William Girdler. And apparently, there was an unfinished sequel. Get this cast. There was an unfinished Grizzly sequel that I guess is somewhere out there. Starring Laura Dern, George Clooney, Charlie Sheen, John Rhys-Davies, Louise Fletcher, and Deborah Foreman. What?
I'm going to need somebody to find that.
I don't know if it's called Grizzly 2. I'm not really sure. But where does that cast come from?
Laura Dern and George Clooney?
Charlie Sheen, John Rhys-Davies, Louise Fletcher, Oscar winner Louise Fletcher from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Is she Nurse Ratched?
Yeah.
Yeah. In Grizzly 2.
Right. I don't know if it's Grizzly 2. I don't know the title. It just says here, you know, you can read up on the unfinished, unreleased sequel to Grizzly. And then, of course, The Edge with Dave. It's David Mamet. Did you ever see The Edge with Anthony Hopkins and Alec Baldwin?
No.
Oh, man. Written by David Mamet? Oh.
This is a bear movie?
Yes. It's a wilderness movie, but there's a bear involved.
Okay.
And it's full on Mamet. Full on Mamet. It is a great movie. A great movie. Really intense. Really good.
So apparently Grizzly 2 was known as Grizzly 2 the Predator.
Uh-huh.
And
is there anything else that we know about
it? It was filmed in 1983, but never saw a proper release.
Oh, that's why George Clooney's in it, because in 1983, nobody knew who the guy was.
Yeah.
He was on Facts of Life at that time. Laura Dern was just a kid. Laura Dern was only like 17. Charlie Sheen was just a kid, too, in 1983. So was Deborah Foreman. Deborah Foreman, that's the year that Valley Girl came out.
Yeah, you can see a super unfinished version of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there it is. There's something to look forward to. That and watching over and over again the New Jersey Devils mascot go smashing through a window.
When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. But now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Two for Tuesday. Yeah, Two for Tuesday. Obviously, the Beatles with help. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. In honor of Crawl, the really terrific, fun alligator attack movie, we are talking about great animal attack movies where animals kill humans, and we're we were talking about killer bear movies, and I want to once again remind everybody that you should, if you've not seen The Edge with Alec Baldwin and Anthony Hopkins, David Mamet wrote it, and it's a nature movie where they're out in the middle of nature and they have to battle a Kodiak bear. It's pretty great. All right, 312-981. 7200 here on WGN. They consider the best killer arachnid movie Arachnophobia. Well, it's in the title. I don't like that movie. I'm the only person who doesn't like that movie.
I mean, I don't love it, but yeah. I think it's quite good.
Some of the other ones: Kingdom of the Spiders with William Shatner, classic. The Black Scorpion from 1957 with incredible stop-motion effects. Best killer snake movie, Spasms. Oliver Reed, this is from 1983, contends with a giant snake with ESP. It features music by Tangerine Dream and some incredible editing to get around the fact that director William Fruitt is working with a full snake puppet. And then, you ever see the movie Venom? With again Oliver Reed. It's a bank bank robbery movie, and a hostage movie with a giant mamba snake thrown in. Klaus Kinski's in it.
What?
Yeah, Klaus Kinski, Oliver Reed from 1981. I saw it at the Gateway Theater.
Oh, my God.
It's a classic. It's in high school when it came out.
Klaus Kinski.
How about the movie You ever see that movie? With Strother Martin? Rich Coase has been known to show on occasion. It is really, truly one of the stupidest movies ever made. Strother Martin plays like a scientist who studies snakes, and he's doing an experiment on Dirk Benedict, who is like an intern. And so he starts injecting Dirk Benedict with this like formula that he's invented. And eventually Dirk Benedict starts to turn into a snake. It is the stupidest. It is just so stupid. I saw it in the theater. And I don't know how many S's it is. I always count them. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 S's.
That seems a little excessive. I feel like you get the point across at 5.
Yeah. So. And then they mention, of course, Anaconda as a great killer snake movie. Forgot Eric Stoltz was in that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Kari Wuhr. I forgot Kari Wuhr was in it, too. I think I need to go back and watch Anaconda again. Danny Trejo's in it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you got to get that and the sequel, Anaconda's Hunt for the Blood Orchid.
Oh, I don't even remember that. Who was in that?
No one of note, really.
Oh, okay. Best killer shark movie. Well, what are we talking about here?
It's very obvious. It's Jaws the Revenge.
Yeah, Jaws the Revenge. Jaws 4. This time it's personal. Look at that. Yeah, Jaws. I mean, come on. I mean, I love Deep Blue Sea. You know, that's a fun shark movie. What are other good shark movies?
Sharktopus.
Sharktopus? Was that another sci-fi movie?
Yeah. I thought The Meg was okay.
Ugh.
It could have been. It wasn't what I wanted it to be.
Oh, wait. Open Water.
Yeah.
The one with Serena from Gossip Girl.
47 Meters Down.
No. From Blake Lively from Gossip Girl. The Shallows. Right?
Yeah, The Shallows was good. That really kind of upset me. Like, that was
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
And you get to see a lot of Blake Lively, too, in that movie. She's in a bikini for 80% of the movie. By the way, they're showing footage of Garth Brooks at Joe's on Weed Street. That's not a dive bar. I just want everybody to know it's not a dive bar.
It's an intimate venue.
How about this other one? We got some runners up. Orca. It's a killer whale.
Gotta have Orca.
Open Water, which is actually a really good movie.
I remember they made a big deal about that movie when it came out.
It was really scary, man.
It got pushed as a very scary movie.
It is.
I think it was on Good Morning America. They did a whole thing on it. Because it was just, it's literally just two people in the middle of water.
Yeah, yeah. But no, it's a very good movie. Best killer ant movie, Phase 4. And runner up would be Them. Well, Them is the giant ants.
Mm-hmm.
You ever see the horror movie called Them from France? The actual title is Eels, ILS.
No, I've never heard of that.
It is one of the scariest movies I've ever seen in my life.
Is it okay?
Do you know the movie what the hell was the movie with Ben from Felicity and Liv Tyler, and they're in the house?
Oh, The Strangers.
Okay, you seen that movie?
Yeah.
Okay, Strangers is a ripoff of Them.
Oh.
Only it's 9 times scarier.
Well, because I like The Strangers.
I think it's okay, but when you see Them,
it'll blow it out of the water.
Forget it. It's not even close. That movie traumatized me. Let me just say, I'm not kidding. Them. It's no exclamation point. It's not the one about ants. It's a home invasion movie. That movie, I have a home invasion phobia. When I was a kid, somebody tried to break into the house and I saw it and it freaked me out. And that's one subgenre that really freaks me out bad. Like, I really freak out when I watch them. I was like in the fetal position during a lot of Them, during the running time of that movie. It's only 87 minutes long. It is unbelievably scary and unbelievably great. All right, here's Jimmy on WGN. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Hey, there's a great movie that's often confused with a Chris Farley comedy. 2006 out of New Zealand, Black Sheep, about killer sheep.
Oh, it's a great movie. Yeah, very, very, very entertaining movie. No question about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Jimmy, thanks.
Thanks, bud.
All right, we got to get out of here. We got the news coming up next. So the Emmy nominations are announced this morning in just a couple of hours. Dan Feinberg is going to join us tomorrow morning for the Emmy nomination special. We're going to do a Know Your Onion. It's Wildcard Wednesday. But, yeah, the big Emmy Award nominations come out this morning. And so Feinberg's going to join us, making a special appearance on a Wednesday morning with us.